5.7 FM, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. We are broadcasting from Manchester, New Hampshire, home of the Republican primary, first in the nation. As we speak, folks are at the polls making their decision. I guess decision 20, not much really of a decision. I think Romney's the guy. All the rest of it's just an exercise on which faction of the radical right you fall upon. Obama hate fest underway. And basically every person I've talked to, and with one exception, I did talk to a person who said, well, you know, we'll have to see. It's all about that black guy in that White House. No one has really been able to articulate to me why each candidate that they've chosen is the guy to lead us out of the trouble we're in. It's all the same ideas, the same policies, the same direction that got us into the mess we're in, which is deregulate, which is cut taxes on the very wealthy, cut investment into the nation, which is basically profitize everything, privatize it all. And, you know, I had a conversation about education earlier today, and, you know, the person quite frankly said, look, if you have children, you should be able to afford to send them to school. If not, they shouldn't get to go to school. Is that how far the Republican Party has come, that they are now emboldened to come forward and say, you know what, we're just going to say it. There's no more dog whistle politic. It is blatantly bold-faced right out there with it. So, interestingly enough, you look at what's going on now, the number of people who are identifying themselves as independents is growing. And I look at what's going on here in Massachusetts, the polarization of the right and how far they've gone off to the deep end. The folks who call themselves independents here, I'm really interested to see where their thoughts come on this. Because issue after issue is taking us further and further to the extreme. And, you know, some of the folks we've talked to from here from the New Hampshire, especially the House, pretty off the deep end. And part of me says this is the radicalization of the nation. And we talked to a woman last night who had done a whole bunch of her doctoral thesis, I think, was in the rise of fascism and how the conditions became such where it was possible. But they didn't even think it was possible that something like that could rise out of their nation. It's just like, I don't think we think it's possible. But all of the conditions that she was talking about, especially demonizing a segment of population. Everything's going wrong in the country because of this person, or everything's going wrong in this country because of this segment, this sliver of the population. And how we address this is we go after them. And we either lock them up or we bomb them or whatever. And then the rest of us, we can we can go back to doing our lives. So I saw this Gallup poll, which has put the number of people who identify themselves as independents at a 60-year high, which I guess isn't surprising. You look at a lot of Democrats who are saying, Obama didn't do exactly what I wanted him to do, and I fall into that category. There are a lot of things I would have liked to have seen this president do a little differently. A lot of that has to do with the politic of the time. A lot of that has to do with the obstructionists, the radicals on the right who have pursued a scorched earth agenda. Like my 3-year-old, when she doesn't get her way, fingers in the ears, kicking the feet, doing all that, screaming and hollering, and there's no discussion to be had there. And I see that's what's going on with this primary, with the folks that I've met here so far. But again, at a 60-year high, 39% of the people polled said that they don't align with either major party. And, when you start talking about, in my opinion, to me, employment issues are at the very top. Economic issues right at the very top. All the social stuff to me is second, third, fourth, fifth tier, down at the bottom. It doesn't affect me directly. But economics affects all of us. What kind of an economy we're going to have in this nation? Who benefits from the fruits of our labor? Who's able to take the profits home? And you look at Romney, who's kind of taken a beating because of his time at Bain Capital, and he should. We've been talking about it on the program for quite some time. You can look back to the 80s and the 90s with the corporate raiders who went in and sucked all the money out of people's pension funds, sold off the profitable assets, saddled the rest of the company with big debt, and then cut them off to die, thus filling their pockets and moving on to do that again and again and again and again. And that's what Bain Capital did. But, you look at someone like Newt Gingrich. He was on one of the board of directors of a company that did the exact same thing. So he was talking about Romney's business experience. And he told NBC, and this is one of those things that you just have to go, really, Newt? He says, apparently looting the companies left people totally unemployed and walked off with millions. He said, look, I'm for capitalism. But if somebody comes in, takes all the money out of your company, and then leaves you bankrupt while they go off with millions, that's not traditional capitalism. And I have to say that is capitalism. That's capital making more capital. This idea that Mitt Romney was in this business for the purpose of creating jobs, for the purpose of making a better nation, is nonsensical. I mean, it defies logic, but that's what they're trying to ram down our throats. He's a good job creator. He did it out of the goodness of his heart. He's such a good businessman that his wonderful decisions created jobs and blah, blah, blah. And you got Gingrich who's saying, he basically looted the company, screwed those people, left them with nothing, but I would never do such a thing. Yet here he is, someone who is on the board of directors of a company who did the exact same thing. The bigger conversation that needs to be had here is, what do we do with these big private equity firms? What do we do with this mass accumulation of capital where you have people like Romney and Bain Capital who have massive amounts of money and with the intent of making more money with no rules on the game? You go back to the 80s, you think about all the pension money that was stolen. You think about all of the companies that were profitable. They were making a reasonable profit. They were plodding along. They were creating good-paying jobs in the communities. They were the anchor of the economy. And in comes these big private equity firms, bought it almost sight unseen, bought these things up because on paper they were worth a lot of money. There were divisions we could sell off. There was machinery we could liquidate. There were pensions we could take from. We could use that money to make more money somewhere else. It's this whole over-leveraging. Well, when you're doing this, who ends up holding the bag? Well, it's the little guy. It's the person who spent 40 years building that company, 40 years, day after day, 40 hours a week, day after day after day, year after year, personally invested in that. So I listen to this argument. Well, he's investing. He's investing in companies. He's not investing. He's gambling. He's figuring out a way to make more return for himself. He's figuring out a way to make sure that he's covered, his profits are made, and the heck with anybody else. That investing to me, and maybe I just have a skewed vision of what it means to invest in a company. When I invest my money in a company, I want to make sure that that company grows. I want to make sure that they have the assets and the resources to create good paying jobs. And this is why I've always thought that the union pension funds should be used for that purpose. I've always believed that there should be one union pension fund to be able to create opportunity for businesses who want to do just that, create decent paying jobs for folks who are going to use that money in the local economy. But that's not the Bain Capital model. The Bain Capital model is, how do I make more money so I can go somewhere else and replicate this model over and over again? Where I go in, I buy something up, I suck all the value out of it, and I leave behind empty buildings, broken dreams, and broken lives. That's the conversation we need to be having. And that is the capitalist model. That's their view. That's the marauder view. I also found it very interesting. He's been taking a beating over his statement that the insurance company will have an incentive to keep you healthy. He says it also means that if you don't like what they do, you can fire them. And he says, I like to be able to fire people that put services to me. And I would, you know, as most people are saying, I think he likes firing people overall. I think it takes some type of it's a personality thing. But the argument on health insurance, do you really think there's an incentive to keep them healthy when they know that they eventually don't have to cover you? Down the line, that they can just keep raising your rates, or they can cut you off? I mean, stop and think about the pay-or-die model. Stop and think about what we've come from. Understand that Medicare has been the catch-all for everybody, and Medicaid has been the catch-all. When you can no longer work, you no longer get insurance. Where do you get that? You get it from Medicaid. Or if you're over 65, you get it from Medicare. So I like what Paul Krugman put out. In one of his books, I think it was Conscience of a Liberal, he talked about amputations due to diabetes. And he showed the fact that 95% of all amputations due to diabetes are paid for by Medicare. Because now once you get to that state, you no longer can work. And we have that pay-or-die model where if you don't have a job, you don't have insurance. And if you don't have insurance, you don't get care. So Medicaid, Medicare picks that up. They want to do away with all that and say to the insurance companies, okay, we're going to let you cover all of those folks, but at what cost? And I go back and I point to my 84-year-old grandmother, who has had a number of ailments throughout the year, who has had a number of surgeries and problems. She got congestive heart failure because she's 84 years old. If we hand her a voucher and say, Granny Smith, you need to go into the private market, and you need to find the insurance that's right for you. She's going to go, I got $15,000, because she doesn't have much else. A little bit of Social Security, a little bit of retirement, a tiny bit of savings left. There's not much more beyond the voucher, and they're saying about $15,000. I pay over $15,000 for the insurance for my family. What do you think an 84-year-old woman's going to end up paying? And these are the conversations that we need to be having with these politicians who keep talking about, well, we need free market solutions and we need private businesses to come in and entrepreneurs and all. Yeah, what's the end goal in all this? And all of that, it's profit. It's the Romney model. It's how do we make more money? How do we invest our money to make more money? It's not about how we provide care for people. It's how do we provide enough care that we can profit massively from it. And you look at the reason our health care is so expensive is because you have got a model set up where you have to feed the investor class. They have to make their money back in order for them to invest in health care. So if someone's going to buy up a community hospital and privatize it, and they're going to spend $100 million on it, they're going to want their money back, and they're going to want it back quickly. They're not going to want it held up for 20 or 30 years. They want it quickly, and they want a return on it so they can take that money and they can go invest in it and get something else and replicate the same model. And that's where we're going. So today, here in Manchester, New Hampshire, the voting across New Hampshire going on as we speak. By the end of tonight, we will know who number two will be. We already know who the winner is going to be. I think Romney in a walk. But who will be number two? Will it be the Paulians? Will it be Gingrich? Will it be Huntsman? And what happens if Huntsman wins? Will this propel him into South Carolina? That's, I guess that's the whole reason for the game tonight, the whole reason we're pursuing that that line. So stick around. We're going to be talking to folks coming here through the Radio Row put on by Talk Radio News Service here at the Radisson Hotel in Manchester, New Hampshire. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Indiana's GOP-controlled legislature is holding a hearing on the proposed anti-union so-called right-to-work bill today. Despite being outgunned by big Republican majorities, the Indiana AFL-CIO's Jeff Harris says there's a fighting chance of defeating the bill. Harris says it's unpopular with Hoosiers, including some Republicans.
Right now, we have a surprising number of allies on the Republican side who either are vehemently opposed to the concept of right to work or don't like the strong-arm tactics that the leadership is using to pass this bill. So we are still very hopeful, cautiously optimistic about our chances to defeat this bill.
Thousands of Indiana citizens opposed to the right to work bill have protested at the state capitol. For the first time since 2009, federal employees could see a small pay raise in 2013. Jesse Russell reports.
President Barack Obama is proposing a 0.5% pay increase for federal employees in his 2013 budget. Republican proposals have called for a one-year extension on a freeze for federal worker pay increases. During the recent pay freeze, workers have continued to receive within-grade step increases, but some of the proposals from Republicans even call for an end to those pay increases. Even if Obama's proposal makes it through the House of Representatives, it is much less than the increase in private sector earnings, which increased by 2% in 2011.
A financial transaction tax is the first step in healing America. Sign our petition at protestintheusa.org.
National Nurses United is pressing for a financial transactions tax on Wall Street as a concrete way to help heal our economy. The Nurses Union says a new report from University of Amherst economists Robert Polin and James Heinz shows that a robust tax on Wall Street transactions would generate significant revenue. National Nurses United says with so many Americans still struggling to recover from the Wall Street Great Recession of 2008, we need a meaningful way to heal our nation. The union says a small tax on major financial trading, which is currently untaxed, is a critical first step. An anti-union group's class action lawsuit attacking the ability of unions to finance political battles is scheduled to be heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. The suit, filed by the National Right to Work Foundation, was filed after SEIU used a special assessment in 2005 to raise money from SEIU members to fight anti-union California ballot proposals. The suit is part of an ongoing national campaign to destroy the political power of workers and their unions by trying to cut off the money needed for workers to effectively fight political attacks. Oral arguments in the case are being heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So Rick Santorum into the talk row. Here we are here in Manchester, New Hampshire, Talk Radio News Services Radio Row. And as we're sitting here, you're seeing candidates come by. You're seeing a number of their surrogates come by, supporters, as the Republican Party and the platform has descended here on Manchester and across New Hampshire. Absolutely the first primary in the country, as this is just an amazing event up here, and I'm so glad we came up to talk with folks. You may not agree with much of what they talk about, but it's worth having a conversation. And I've got Al Baldessaro. He is a state representative here in the New Hampshire state. Al, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Folks are coming by, they're talking about who they're supporting. I understand you're a Rick Perry supporter.
I am a proud supporter, yes, of Rick Perry.
What is it that pulls your support to Mr. Perry, Governor Perry?
What motivates me about Rick Perry is what he's done in Texas here with jobs. He's motivated other companies to move into Texas. What he's done for the veterans there, he has out of 8 veterans' homes there, so that means 50% taxpayers' money is going to take care of veterans in his state. He's taking care of the veterans that are coming home from the war, whereas if they're 100% disabled, they pay no property taxes. I mean, I'm the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, retired Marine, and he's wearing the uniform, so he knows what it is to not let one veteran slip through the cracks.
And, you know, I think that's something that every American can agree on. I don't think this is that's a Republican or a Democratic issue. I think taking care of those...
I have to disagree with you here, you know that.
Well, if we have to, we can go back to the Bush years and talk about how badly the Bush years were for veterans. And we can go back into Vietnam if we have to. Because where I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, I saw those men coming back from war, dumped into our society like trash. So that's one of the things that I have a problem with. But I do believe it should be, if you disagree with me, it should be an American issue, not a Republican or a Democrat issue.
I agree with you. It is an American issue. But you want to know something? For many years, Republicans and Democrats have used veterans as political pawns.
Absolutely.
During an election. Made many promises, and they don't come through. When election's over, we're forgotten.
And Republicans are no better than Democrats.
Did you notice I said Republicans and
right
Democrats?
I'm there with you.
But Rick Perry, not only he made it happen in his state to make sure that veterans didn't slip through. We're doing everything in the state. Me as the chairman here to make sure that all veterans are protected. It's nonpartisan on my committee when it comes to veterans issues. But they all use this as political pawns. The one who I look at, who has a record taking care of veterans, and Rick Perry has that record.
If what you're saying is true, I will be more than happy to give him the credit he's due on that, because as a nation, we should be taking care of
them. Oh, you're 100% right.
And we shouldn't be shortchanging them. We shouldn't be cutting funding to the VA. We should be doing none of that.
Do you see what they're doing right now? They're looking at the cuts of the DOD. They're going after military retirement, military benefits.
I think it's a disgrace.
And they want to balance the budget off of that instead of anything else.
And again, that's both parties.
Right. No.
But again, it's the big spending cutters in your party that seem to be pushing for that the most. Well, I mean, I don't think Obama would have gone after it had it not been put in front of him by the Republicans.
Actually, that came under the Obama study committee that he put in place. The retirement, and that had nothing to do with the Republicans.
It absolutely did. It was part of the negotiation of the bill that came out. See, this person that you can say a lot of things about, but he's actually tried to reach across the aisle. And time after time again, he gets slapped in the face. And I'm hoping at some point he wakes up.
How can you reach across the aisle and keep taking out of people's pockets? And you expect the other side of the aisle to agree. I got to disagree with you.
Okay, you can disagree with me, but if you want to talk about debt,
right.
If you want to talk about how much money has been put under the national debt, it is the Republican Party who has been masterful at raising that thing up.
Well,
you go back to the Reagan years, the Star Wars waste, you go back to the Bush tax cuts, all of that money added to our debt at a much higher rate than any of the Democrats.
Didn't the Star Wars bring us Patriots missiles and other stuff that came out, which is knocking stuff out of the sky? And didn't that Star Wars money there bring in other types of missiles that are used, which we won't bring up here?
It was part of it.
With the study that, I mean, I know
but
myself in Desert
at the
Storm.
Time. But there were generals at the time that said, we don't need it. We don't want it. There are generals today that say we're spending money on stuff we don't want or need. And I don't really want to go into that direction. I want to talk about Rick Perry.
There you go.
Because, you know, he said something the other day that scares the hell out of me. That if he were president, we're going back to Iraq.
I have to agree with him. Now, listen about what he said. First of all, nobody's talking about the thousands of troops that are sitting there in Kuwait. We've got problems with Iran. We don't know what's going to happen over in Iran with their nuclear and what they wanted. They want us dead. Whether we like it or not, whether we agree or disagree, I've been to many of these countries.
Let me ask you want them dead?
No, I don't.
See, because how they're seeing that is by doing this stuff, they say, well, Americans want us dead.
I've been to these countries. These fundamentalists, want to kill us. They're threatened by our freedoms, our religious freedom. And if you haven't been in those countries there, it's a big difference. I served in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, been to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait.
And I've talked to numerous people who have done it as well.
You know,
and they tell there's a sect of that religion that thinks that way. But I would argue there's a sect of the Christian faith that I go by that thinks the same way.
I agree. I think Rick Perry, what he's saying is not that he wants to go back into Iraq. He wants to be prepared in case we have to.
I heard him say the other day is, if I were president, we'd be back in Iraq.
We'd be back. Right, but does
we'd
that
go
mean,
back.
But does that mean that he's going to send them in? No. When you got a 30-second spot or 15, you don't get a chance to explain what you meant. He's not going to put the troops back in Iraq. I'm sure there's no doubt in my mind.
Okay, so again, he misspoke.
No, it's not that he misspoke. He didn't get a chance to finish it.
Oh, okay. Because he, you know, and I guess this is a knock against Rick Perry. He has a tendency of things just, in his own words, just falling out of his mouth.
Well, so
let me ask you, as one of the most the biggest part of the president's job, foreign policy, can we have someone who just has a tendency of things falling out of their mouth? I think of George Bush, for instance, when he said this is a crusade. To me, that says, wow, this is real trouble. We're talking about Christians and Muslims fighting when we should have been talking about these terrorists who came after our country. Instead, he took it to a whole other plane.
Well, there was reasons why I went into Iraq, and I'm sure he did take it to another. He did explain himself. Now,
why did we go into Iraq?
We went into Iraq because of the attack. What they were doing there with the paying $25,000 to terrorists to attack Israel and other countries. Okay.
I thought it was
Saddam.
Wasn't that a master instruction?
No. Well, tell that a lot of us veterans that are sick from Desert Storm that there was no chemicals there. And I'll tell the president, any one of them, you're a damn liar.
Oh, no, I know they had weapons of master instruction.
That's right.
Instruction.
And there's a lot of us sick from that.
Sure. And you know how I know? Because we gave them to them.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. You're right. We did.
So, again, you start thinking about foreign policy. You start thinking about the decisions we've made throughout the globe of backing one dictator over another, one regime
Both
over
parties.
Another.
You're right.
You know, I guess you could make the argument that Ron Paul would have the right ideas. Do like George Washington and the founders thought of. Stay the hell out of their business. Stay here at home. Make this country the best place on earth. Fund our health care. Fund our education. And leave them people alone.
Well, these people there were getting nuclear weapons. They were getting ways to figure out a way. They attacked us. We didn't attack. They attacked our embassies. They attacked our bases over the years. We did nothing for many years under Republican Democrat. I remember being in Hawaii when Reagan sent missiles over to Libya because of the plane that got shot out of the sky. We let things go and go and go and go for many years. And then they bombed the Twin Towers once before. You think we would have been smart enough, okay, to be watching what's going on. They cut our FBI, CIA, intel capabilities over the years. So we don't know that these people are planning. There's a lot that's gone on.
There's
over
a lot
and
of intelligence.
At our
and there's
embassies.
A lot of cherry-picked intelligence as well.
But the bottom line, there's no doubt in my mind, Perry wear the uniform and understand.
Perry's your
if
guy.
You never served, it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback and think and assume and understand strategies. But if you never been involved in that world or in that picture and seen the real picture of what goes on, you don't know. I eat, sleep, and drink it every night, what I seen in those countries or what they did. You know, now, not all Muslims are bad. Don't get me wrong. There are people thriving who want freedom.
And those are the people we should be helping.
In Iraq, we planted the seed of freedom. In Afghanistan, we did the same thing. The other countries are threatened by that plant, that seed. The generations from then on, growing up, are going to remember that. They're going to appreciate.
Well, and that's what we should be doing.
Right.
So when I hear your party say that we should be cutting all funding overseas, that worries me because the forces in those countries that want change, we're now cutting a lifeline off to them.
I don't think they said they want to cut all funding.
That's pretty much been a tenet of your party.
Perry said he'd zero it out and then take a look at who's our friends.
Okay.
And that's to help who our friends are.
Right,
why should we be giving money to countries that want to kill us?
I've been asking that question for years.
I've been there.
But you want to support people who, from the ground up, who are going to help you out.
Well,
and I think before Bush made that turn into Iraq, I thought there was a moment there where they held candlelight vigils in Tehran after the building after the towers went down.
Right.
There was an opportunity there, but it was our push towards extremism that sent them to become nationalistic and go, you know what? The Americans are going to come after us next.
Well,
and there's that mentality that bothers me. If we're doing this kind of rushing after people and this militaristic, we need bases everywhere, we need to be bombing people, what do you think they're going to think?
You know, I can go back on lessons learned over and over. I was there part of it for 22 years active duty.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you, I know. But the bottom line is we're looking for here from today on to move forward.
Absolutely. Should we be
coming together as one country here to make sure that we're protected. Our borders are protected. Okay? But this stuff of what's going on overseas, these countries, there are many Islamists that want to kill us.
There are many Americans that want to kill them.
We have some terrorists in our country, in our own country, that are just waiting. No doubt in my mind. Little by little, our CIA, FBI are picking them up.
Absolutely. But the thing is we've got some Christian terrorists as well.
Without a doubt, I agree.
Timothy McVeigh.
That's why it's important to keep a strong military in the ready position to protect our freedoms. Little by little,
and I think every American
taken
needs,
away.
What do you think about going back to a conscription or a mandatory service program? Like some other
I don't
countries.
Support a draft.
Not at all?
Not at all. I don't support a draft. Because if you take a look, when you put a draft in, you're taking everybody. Now you've got to keep weeding out. Only the strong survive in the military. You've got to weed out the societies, you know, people that just
but
don't,
if every
don't
person
have that
had
leadership
to give some
potential.
Service. If every person had to give some service,
what
so every person would have some skin in the game.
I'm going to speak only for the Marine Corps.
I'm just asking.
I'm going to speak for the Marine Corps because I retired from the Marine Corps.
Okay.
Marine Corps trains every day to fight wars. We don't have time to try to take somebody, keep taking people from society that don't want to be there. They were forced in there.
Point well taken.
Okay, we're not a society, you know what I mean? We're not a experiment, social experiment. Put somebody in and, oh, he's going to be a good Marine. Don't happen.
Okay, good. Let's move on a little bit. Let's talk about the job creation that happened in Texas. Statistics have come out and say that, you know, the jobs down there, he has created the most jobs in the country during his span since the recession. But they also have the second highest number of minimum wage jobs. So the question I have is that the direction that we want for the entire country? Where we're creating jobs, but they're not family sustaining jobs.
I'd have to take a look at that because on that statistic on who did it and where it came from.
That's pretty much
because if you take a look at when you bring in more industry, pops up also is all these little businesses, 7-Eleven, gas stations,
minimum wage jobs,
shop, minimum wage jobs. But those jobs, if you're in those jobs, you got to have. Not everyone's educated. Not everyone can go out and pour concrete and build a house. So you've got to have work for those people that don't have the trade or the training in them. So God bless them if they got those jobs coming in to help the ones that aren't educated to be able to be doing something instead of being on the government rolls.
All right, let's talk about his labor policies. He's a big fan of right to work. So Texas is a great state because it's a right to work state. Yet you look at the unemployment rates in states across this country, six of the top 10 states with the high unemployment numbers, right-to-work states. They have a lower standard of living. Their workers tend to have less health care, less pension benefits. Again, back to the question, is this the direction we want for the nation?
Well, no, but we want right-to-work states here because it does bring in more companies. It does bring in more industry.
It brings. If you do what Mitt Romney wants to do and make this a right-to-work nation, you lose that argument you can only beggar thy neighbor so much. You can only go, hey, Massachusetts, we're right to work. Move your jobs here. Once you're a right to work nation, that's it. All you have to do is go downward because now you have no way to collect.
I'm going to give you an example. Well, you're not from New Hampshire, right?
No, I.
Okay. You know, many of the cities and towns here in New Hampshire are struggling. They can't afford no more. Unions getting great pay raises. I see you got union Teamsters and your Solidarity. Okay, we can't afford it no more. The taxpayers have no more money.
But that's what you're sitting at
do.
A bargaining table.
But the bottom line is that bargaining table, something's got to give here. The taxpayers can't afford it no more. You keep saying wages, wages, wages. Okay?
No, I keep
right
saying
to work
voice. I keep saying voice on the job, better hours, better conditions, health care benefits, whatever. But you do this at the bargaining table. You do not. You're the government. You're the small government party. Get government out of my life. Why do you want government stealing my right and the employer's right to have an agreement between two parties?
See, I don't
why
see
would
it.
There, well, I know
see
you
that.
Don't see it.
I don't
that
see
way.
That at all because I see companies being taken over by unions coming in. People have been working there for years and years and years.
Companies
and
aren't
all
being
of a sudden,
taken over.
Well, they
you,
have.
This is the adversarial problem that we have in this country. You seem to think it's adversarial. I believe that unions want companies to be as profitable as they can be so they can make better wages. You know, the guy who founded the AFL, a guy named Samuel Gompers, said it should be a crime for a company not to operate at a
profit. You know, my father was a union person. They started the union in Cambridge, Massachusetts out of donations, not mandatory taking money from people, hard-working people in the city of Cambridge. They waited up until the gentleman there that started the union there passed away. Then the Teamsters stepped in and took over. Then people started paying more money out of their pockets. That union took care of workers every day on donations. Now, people on the top, their pockets are getting deeper. There's more and more money being paid into Republican and Democrats, into the political world. There's no reason for that. We already got unions years ago. There was a reason for them. When my father and many other fathers.
There's still a reason
grandpa,
for them.
Well, no.
There are people dying on the job. Hampshire. There are people getting sick on the
here,
job.
It can't be all about unions here in New Hampshire
it's
or any other state.
It's not all about unions.
It has to be about attracting other companies that won't be scared to be able to have a union come in, force their money, you know, the cost of their, you know, person an hour to go up. And next thing you know, you knock them out of the market. They can't afford, they got to go to China or somewhere else. Look at the many countries.
So you want us to compete with? You want us to have to compete on wages and benefits with the Chinese workers?
No,
is
nobody,
that where you're putting?
Nobody ever said that. I said many. What happened is?
Well, you just said they're going to move to China
because companies have moved to China because they can't afford the high wages. Some companies, until they become marketable, you can't bring in a union and knock them down. But this isn't about unions. This is about Rick Perry running for president, who believes in right to work. You may not. I support it. There are many in New Hampshire legislators who support it. We just didn't have enough for the right to work. But it passed.
So let me ask you, what right do I get in under right to work, and does it guarantee any work?
You get the right to either say, I want to be a member of a union or not. You get the right to say, as an American, where many veterans gave their lives, to say, I don't want to pay for a union, but I'm still working for this company.
But you've got the right to leave.
You have the right to stay.
So is your right sacrosanct over mine?
No. Why? If you're working
in
a union,
if the people in the place, all of us, we want to have a union, and right. You don't, should your rights supersede ours?
Your rights should be able to stay there and work. You go have your union. I just don't want to be part of it. That's like being on the playground. If they're playing basketball, you don't want to play basketball. Go play baseball.
That's right. You go somewhere else.
No,
very good.
Hal
D'Alessandro, I appreciate the time. It is great talking with you, sir.
Yeah.
Good luck to Rick Perry today.
Don't count Rick Perry out.
I'm hoping he still stays right to the end.
He's got that veteran mentality. We get knocked down, we get back up, we take the hill.
Thank God.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Have a good one. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
But I do believe in what a crazy man can do.
Hey! Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
A bipartisan majority in Washington has been quietly funding a multi-million-dollar educational initiative to lift people up. Great! Except that the initiative is not for hard-hit Americans, but for Afghanistan. Actually, only top Afghan officials can participate and get ready to upchuck. This so-called educational effort is to teach the corrupt leaders of President Hamid Karzai's regime the art of public relations. Specifically, how to hold news conferences. How's that going, you ask? Not well. Though in fairness, let's acknowledge that Karzai's officials have at least begun to hold a few actual press meetings. Previously, Afghan ministries required the media to submit any questions by fax, which was a bit of a runaround since they had no working fax machines. So, this is counted as a giant step forward. Now, though, U.S. instructors have abruptly withdrawn from the PR school. Apparently, they're annoyed that Karzai and his cohorts keep criticizing and frustrating our efforts to help them establish a functioning government. Last year, for example, the Afghan Attorney General expelled American advisors from his office after they kept pushing him to prosecute cases of blatant corruption against his fellow officials. Still, while our advisors, instructors, and mentors have been pulled, our money has not. American financing of the PR school continues. It's all part of our $8 billion tax dollars a month, that Washington keeps airlifting into Afghanistan, while our own people's educational and job training needs are being slashed. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, at least Obama is getting us out of Afghanistan in 2014, right? Well, he says so, but Pentagon war hawks say they want to negotiate with Karzai to keep thousands of American forces there and billions more of our tax dollars beyond Obama's deadline.
If you'd like more of Jim Hightower's real populism, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter gives you the real lowdown on which corporations, by name, are doing what to the middle class, our environment, and our democracy. Each month, the Hightower Lowdown brings you facts you didn't know, along with actions you can take to fight back. It also comes with a sense of humor. Hightower believes we can fight the gods and still have fun. Plus, get this, it's cheap. Only $15 brings you 12 issues a year. For real populism, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
We found- found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it'll probably fail, but our machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires.
That's Joe. We are here in Manchester, New Hampshire at the Talk Radio News Service Radio Row. And I gotta tell you, that guy, I like him. Those are the kind of conversations that we need to be having. Granted, I don't know if we changed anything. I don't know if the world's gonna be a better place tomorrow because of it. But you did hear what he had to say, which is he wants us to compete with China. The idea that we need to start pulling wages down. We need to make sure that people don't have the ability to collective bargain. And I go back to that whole idea of beggar thy neighbor. And I probably should have kept him for another segment to go over this idea that you're going to be stealing jobs from one state to another. Are we one nation? Is it country first? Or is it, hey, what can I get for myself? You know, they love that under God thing, but they seem to forget the one nation under God. So this idea that we can beggar thy neighbor, we can pick other people, because, hey, we've got worse conditions. We need economic development based on who's willing to race to the bottom. Who's willing to pay their employees less? Who's willing to have work for less health care? Who's willing to work for less pension? Who's willing to work in different conditions? Well, we don't need to pay overtime. No. I mean, because that's the next thing that's coming. The next thing is coming is shifting how things are done. Maybe we'll work 80-hour weeks. You'll have next week off just to meet the business cycle. How much more business-friendly do we need to be? See, what I think we need to be doing, instead of pursuing this anti-worker agenda, instead of pursuing how do we make us competitive with China, how do we compete? You heard him say it. We have to compete with China. Why do we have to compete with China? We've been put into this fight. Why? Because we have politicians like that. We have both Republicans and Democrats who pursue these trade policies that put us in a position where, you know what? We lose. We lose every time. We, the working people. The investor class does very well. Because then they bring those products back here. They hand us a nice little credit card. Because our wages aren't going up, so we want to continue to have the standard of living that we've become accustomed to. So we go into debt. We take out second mortgages. We take out home equity loans. We do all of these things to keep that standard of living up. And we're paying that money, buying those things. And where does it go? It goes upward. You know, you think about all the jobs that have been created all over the world by American investors. Big American companies who have divested from the U.S., who have walked away from the U.S. Now, you got Obama tomorrow is going to have some forum where they're going to say, please, insource into the U.S. because, you know, things are getting worse here. Things are bad enough that you can bring it back. Labor costs are cheap. And, oh, you don't have to worry about that right-to-work stuff because, you know, the Republicans are going to kill that. Is that the nation? And I ask this time and time again, is this the nation that we need? Is this the direction we need to be going as a country? And I sure hope it's not. Because I think back to my grandfather. I think back to that generation who fought for a better tomorrow. I think back to that generation that fought for their children to do better than they did and their grandchildren to do even better still. And to think back and go, you know, my grandfather fought World War II so that they could steal rights from workers. He's got to be spinning in his grave. And that generation, there's a reason that some call them the greatest generation, because they thought of someone else. They thought of the future. They thought of their children and their grandchildren. The people that I've met here in Manchester, this is truly the GOME. It's not the GOP anymore. It's the GOME. It's how much is in it for me? What am I going to get out of this? And that, my friends, is what's extremely frustrating. So, but I got to be honest, I like the fact that he was honest about the military. I like the fact that he was honest that it was both Republicans who have walked away from it and Democrats in most cases. We should be funding, and I wish I would have gotten into that. We could have funded why the funding for the VA has gone down so much, especially during the Bush years. That would have been a whole other discussion. We're going to have to try and get him back. Remember his name. Anyway, take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
We are here in Manchester, New Hampshire, the Radisson Hotel, Talk Radio News Services Radio Row. And, you know, I go back to the guy we talked to a moment ago. A good, fiery discussion. That's the reason that someone like me would come to the Republican primary. It's not that I agree with their issues, and you know that. But it's about having the discussion. If we can't talk, we're in big trouble. I've asked Dan Pashman to come sit down here with me. He's the he's working for the folks over at Americans Elect, AmericanElect.org. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dan Pashman's name. Dan, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
What is Americans Elect?
Well, it's the first national online primary. It's an exciting, I mean, this November, when Americans go to the ballot, there's going to be three candidates there to choose from. There's going to be a Republican, a Democrat, and an Americans Elect candidate in all 50 states, and that candidate will have been chosen directly by the American people through an internet convention. And it's the first time it's ever happened, and we expect it to, well, first off, revolutionize politics, give Americans more power, more say than we've ever had before, and have a big impact in the election.
You know, I've always asked for a third party or a fourth party or whatever, but in my view, it's not possible without having a mechanism like instant runoff voting, because I look back to 2000, and this could be a bad example, but, you know, if my conscience was to vote for Ralph Nader, but reality, I should have voted for Al Gore, or if you voted for Pat Buchanan, and you should have voted for Bush, I see that, you know, this could be a problem where you have the same kind of scenario that happened there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand the Nader analogy. I think that in our case, I don't think that it would apply. I think a better analogy is someone like Ross Perot,
okay,
who is more a middle-of-the-road candidate, who polls show drew equally from the Republican and Democratic candidate. One of the interesting things about our process is that the presidential candidate that the American people choose through AmericansElect.org will have to pick a vice presidential nominee from a party other than his or her own.
Interesting.
And so you're going to get a balanced ticket, an artisan ticket that we'd be able to govern with a lot less guard for partisan political interests. But that also means that the ticket is a lot more likely to draw from both sides and not to draw only from one side.
I mean, because if you look at today's politics, I got to be honest, I blame the American voter. I mean, the reason that our politicians are so polarized is because we've become polarized as a people, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it probably becomes a sort of, you know, chicken or the egg kind of thing, but I think that there's no question that the polarization, well, you know, the polarization is there, but I personally think that the American people are a lot less polarized than our politicians are. I think that if you look at a lot of polls, you know, the media tells us that it's sort of like an upside-down bell curve where almost everyone is either on the far right or the far left and there's no one in the middle.
Right.
But the truth is, most Americans can agree on a fair number of things, and those of us who maybe can't agree on a few things, you know, can probably find a reasonable compromise. Most of us don't hate each other. Most of us don't want to take each other down.
True.
But that's the way our country's governed, as if that's the case.
And that's how the game's played, I guess. So let me ask you, the people who are going to be in this primary, who decides who gets to be on the ballot for the online primary? Who decides who these candidates are going to be?
The American people decide.
So I can put myself in.
You can. Are you over 35 years old?
Yes.
Have you been living in the United States for 14 years?
Yes.
Okay, then you're constitutionally eligible.
So it can be, I guess that's a grassroots organizing thing. But if you're doing something in a local area, how's that going to apply to other areas? I guess that's the question.
Well, the beauty of the Internet is that it would give even a local candidate the ability to make his or her message heard all over the country. And we're very excited about the ability of regular Americans to run for president through this process, or perhaps there are politicians out there who are inspirational leaders that don't want to deal with the grueling party process that you have to go through. I mean, there's no Democrat or anyone on the left who's going to try for the Democratic nomination this year, right?
Right.
And there are a whole lot of people on the right who probably might want to consider being running for president who would never go through this process.
Help. Sure.
And also to have to kowtow to the party and to the party's base, because, you know, with this primary process, you see these candidates, they kowtow to the base, and the general election comes, they got to move to the middle.
Right.
You know, why not have the mainstream American sentiment, the ones who pick the candidates in the first place?
That sounds like a great idea. You know, let me ask you this, as you go down this process, who does all this work to get all these people on these ballots? I mean, because as you pointed out, look, I'm not going to be able to go through all the filings and have all the money and the resource to do this. Who does all this?
Well, we've already been working on it for months, and we've got people all over the country collecting signatures. We've collected over 2 million signatures already, including in California, the biggest electoral state, in Ohio, in Florida, some key swing states. We collected over 1.6 million signatures in California, the largest signature gathering drive there in that state's history, which has seen some pretty big petition drives in California. So we're really excited about that, and it's been some intense work.
Very last question I've got for you. What do you do if you have a situation where you have 34% of the voters voting for one candidate, now you've got an unpopular guy?
You mean if Americans elect...
You got three people. If one of them gets 34%, two of them get 33%. You've got a guy who's now president...
Oh,
66% of the people don't want.
Well, that would be an issue for any plurality winner. The good news for ours is that it would be a balanced ticket who can reach across party lines and get something done.
Beautiful. I'd love to talk to you again in the future when we have more time.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Dan Pashman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, I look at this, and again, part of what I find interesting is you go back to this. Can we have a politician? Can we have this type of opportunity? Can we have this type of opportunity where you're going to have this third party? Is that at all possible? So, you know, when I look at this, I think it's a great idea. It's part of what a lot of folks want to see. I'd love to see a Labor Party. I would love to see someone who has stronger labor views than both the Democrats or the Republicans. Because at the end of all of this, it comes down to, like he said, what the American people really want to do. And as we've talked about, I go back to this AmericanElects.org site. And I hope we have a chance to talk to Dan Pashman. I hope we can talk more about what the whole idea is, what the point is that he's trying to get across. And I think we should start a movement. We need to find somebody to get on that and start doing it as well. Anyway, but as we talked about earlier, I've got like 3 minutes left to the break. Okay, well, I've got Bill Burton here with me, Priorities USA.
We are a super PAC to help the president get reelected.
Oh, so you're one of them.
We're one of them.
So how do you like Obama Hate Fest 2012?
I've actually been surprised at the lack of energy that Republicans have demonstrated up here. It doesn't seem like people are all that fired up about any of these guys, and the one front runner is losing steam every moment.
Yeah, and it's what's interesting to me is how they're eating their own. I mean, Gingrich going after Romney for destroying jobs when Gingrich himself was on a board of directors of a company doing the exact same thing.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, folks will say and do crazy things in the middle of a campaign season, but I think that this attack on Romney is particularly effective, and it gets at, you know, what is his business experience and what would the practical application of it be if he were president? So it's something that's given people a lot of doubts. And I think it's going to be a big problem for him.
You know, for you folks at Priorities USA, isn't this an opportunity to have that conversation about what kind of an economy we want to have? Do we want to have an economy where you have some entity like Bain Capital or any of the other thousands of private equity firms who make their living off of sucking assets out of a company and cutting them off to die?
I think that's exactly right. I think that this is the exact conversation that Americans are going to have now, and if Mitt Romney's the nominee throughout the fall, to determine, you know, what kind of person Mitt Romney is and what kind of steward he would be of our economy. Someone who's comfortable just laying people off in order to extract as much profit as he could is probably not going to have the best interests of, you know, regular Americans at heart as he's making decisions in the Oval Office.
Now, the Obama people, I'm sure, are going to be in South Carolina, where this, you know, is going to be a big issue down in South Carolina, considering they pretty much lost all of their furniture industry, all of their textile industry,
yeah,
because of things just like this.
No,
what
exactly
opportunities
right.
are there for the Obama folks, do you think?
Well, I actually think South Carolina is going to be the biggest inter-party bloodbath that we've seen yet. Newt Gingrich's PAC has already put up millions of dollars a year to run these ads about Bain Capital and Mitt Romney's record there and the impact that it had on workers. And so I think what you'll see there is a real Republican-on-Republican fight.
What do you say to the... I've looked at this Republican Party, and it's, to me, they have this no rights at work agenda, and they are hell-bent on steam my right and workers' rights to collective bargaining. And, you know, the party that tells me they want small, less intrusive government is telling me that they want to put the government right between me and my employer so that we can't come to an agreement.
Right. That's exactly right. These folks are anti-worker. They're anti-workers' rights. They are against all the things that are important to middle-class families and the things that actually would help our economy get going in a way that benefits all Americans, not just the wealthiest.
So do you think the president is finally, I said he stole Michelle Bachmann's titanium spine when she dropped out recently, because I gave him credit. He appointed Cordray. He appointed the folks at the National Labor Relations Board. I got to tell you, that steely spine a little bit, is he going to learn that going forward?
He is hitting his stride, make no mistake, and I think that he's pretty effectively shown the fight that he has to the American people, and yeah, we keep on that. I feel pretty good about his chances to get reelected.
All right, thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
I'm hoping, as I said before, that campaign Obama that we saw last time will become campaign Obama again, and then into the second term, remain that guy. I think he walked away from it for a little bit. I think the fact that, everybody went home. I'm hoping we learned that lesson. That if you get the guy elected again, that you stand, you fight, and you stay activated, engaged in the process. Because the Republicans, they're trying to build that infrastructure. They're trying to build that grassroots support. It's not happening, but they're trying. And you look here, he's right. There's not much enthusiasm here. I was in the lobby listening to some of the disgruntled attendees. Talking about, yeah, we're bird watching, but there aren't many birds to be seen. And they're taking pictures with people who I don't recognize. And they're really excited about it. And good for them. That's what this is about. It's about having that engagement. It's about having the ability to be part of the process and to feel like you're part of the process. That's what I like about what's going on up here in New Hampshire. So the votes are going on as we speak. Hopefully by the time we go off air, we'll have some understanding of what's going on and what the numbers may be. So I'm looking forward to some of that. Again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Unfortunately, we can't take any phone calls here at the Radio Row. So, again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast at our site there at thericksmithshow.com. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Quick break, right back. Stick around. We are in Manchester, New Hampshire. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Indiana's GOP-controlled legislature is holding a hearing on the proposed anti-union so-called right-to-work bill today. Despite being outgunned by big Republican majorities, the Indiana AFL-CIO's Jeff Harris says there's a fighting chance of defeating the bill. Harris says it's unpopular with Hoosiers, including some Republicans.
Right now, we have a surprising number of allies on the Republican side who either are vehemently opposed to the concept of right to work or don't like the strong arm tactics that the leadership is using to pass this bill. So we are still very hopeful, cautiously optimistic about our chances to defeat this bill.
Thousands of Indiana citizens opposed to the right to work bill have protested at the state capitol. For the first time since 2009, federal employees could see a small pay raise in 2013. Jesse Russell reports.
President Barack Obama is proposing a 0.5% pay increase for federal employees in his 2013 budget. Republican proposals have called for a one-year extension on a freeze for federal worker pay increases. During the recent pay freeze, workers have continued to receive within-grade step increases, but some of the proposals from Republicans even call for an end to those pay increases. Even if Obama's proposal makes it through the House of Representatives, it is much less than the increase in private sector earnings, which increased by 2% in 2011.
A financial transaction tax is the first step in healing America. Sign our petition at protestintheusa.org.
National Nurses United is pressing for a financial transactions tax on Wall Street as a concrete way to help heal our economy. The Nurses Union says a new report from University of Amherst economists Robert Polin and James Heinz shows that a robust tax on Wall Street transactions would generate significant revenue. National Nurses United says with so many Americans still struggling to recover from the Wall Street Great Recession of 2008, we need a meaningful way to heal our nation. The union says a small tax on major financial trading, which is currently untaxed, is a critical first step. An anti-union group's class action lawsuit attacking the ability of unions to finance political battles is scheduled to be heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. The suit, filed by the National Right to Work Foundation, was filed after SEIU used a special assessment in 2005 to raise money from SEIU members to fight anti-union California ballot proposals. The suit is part of an ongoing national campaign to destroy the political power of workers and their unions by trying to cut off the money needed for workers to effectively fight political attacks. Oral arguments in the case are being heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So we are here at Obama Hate Fest 2012 in the center of... Well, the Republican primary here in Manchester, New Hampshire, getting the head shakes from the radicals. Very interesting. I'm sitting here with David Korn from Mother Jones, also a contributor over at MSNBC. David, thanks for taking time for me.
It's great to be with you, Rick.
So what do you see in here? Everybody I talk to, it seems like it's Obama Hate Fest. Whether they're for one guy or another, they all agree, unified, 100%. It's that black guy in the White House.
Yeah, well, you know, Rick's interim says, you know, have the courage to fight for America. I don't know who he wants to fight against or what the fight is. He doesn't get that specific. But I have a piece up, as we were talking a moment ago, on MotherJones.com, in which I sort of try to move away from the horse race. It's very easy when you get up here to talk about who's up, who's down, how Huntsman is doing, what's up with Ron Paul and Romney, which I love to do as much as anybody else. And I go on the shows, and I do that, and I write about that. But I also like to take a step back and look at sort of the messages that are being conveyed this week. And if you listen to the rhetoric coming from, particularly from Romney, Santorum, and Gingrich, you see that again and again and again, they are trying to define Barack Obama as the other, someone who's not truly an American. Mitt Romney, in all his campaign speeches, goes on about how Obama does not understand American values. He doesn't understand the special nature of America. He doesn't understand freedom and opportunity. So in essence, he's saying he's not really one of us. And then if you go to, and the way he describes it, which is interesting, you know, coming from his Bain Capital background, he says he believes that the government should take money from some and give to others. So he sort of focuses on Obama as being a redistributionist as proof that he's not truly American, without explaining if he himself, Romney, would end, say, Medicare or Pell Grants, which all are, you know, bottom line redistribution programs. But if you then turn towards Santorum and Gingrich, whose rhetoric overlaps even more, they go further. They're more dour. They actually say not that Obama doesn't understand American values, that he wants to destroy American values. That he, you know, that he does not believe in a country where the people rule the government, but he wants a country where the government rules the people. And that, if, you know, I saw Rick Santorum last night, who said if we don't stop Barack Obama, he will change this country for good, and it no longer will be an independent nation. We will no longer have freedom. We will no longer have liberty. And, you know, Newt Gingrich has been out there saying he's the most radical American president in history, and he wants America to become a secular, radical European socialist nation. Now, all this stuff is kind of phony and false, but you see, it's not even a dog whistle. A dog whistle can only be heard from the other side. It's like a bullhorn to people who look at Barack Obama, and either because he's a black guy or because he's not a conservative or because he's a Democrat, they say he's not really part of America. He's not part of the American story. This is sort of a slightly more sophisticated version of birtherism, saying he's not born in this country. They're not saying he's not born in this country. They're just saying he's not one of us.
He's not one of us, sure. And in my opinion, it's that they have no new ideas. They don't know how to solve the problem, so they have to create this outsider, someone to go after and destroy.
Yeah, and it really, I mean, it's demagogic, and it's playing upon the fears and the anxieties.
But isn't that where they live?
Yeah, exactly.
At the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy? Yeah. Isn't that where they...
I mean, it is. And, you know, and now, and they've really been able with Obama to make that a target. I mean, this, you know, forget the fact that he, you know, saved the auto industry, you know, even if you have criticism about how it was done, or that he killed bin Laden. I mean, he still is not American. I mean, what does the guy have to do?
He's leading from behind, David. Yeah. He's leading from behind.
I mean, I saw there was a great David Axelrod quote recently. He said, I think our slogan should be that Obama saved GM and killed bin Laden. And if you don't, he at least should be made. Listen, okay, you think he's not a real American? For killing bin Laden, saving the auto industry, and preserving a million jobs that way, or whatever the number might be, can't we at least make him an honorary American?
I mean, I think it's a lot better off what you've laid out, a lot better than what they've done over at Bain Capital and what Romney accomplished, which is, you know, throwing hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets and making sure that they redistribute wealth from those working people to him.
I know, and now, you know, thanks to Newt Gingrich, the biggest hypocrite in New Hampshire, you know, and until tomorrow, you know, it's become an issue. Newt, you know, has become an economic populist, attacking Bain Capital for being looters and corporate raiders, when at the same time he was on the advisory board to Forstmann Little, which just happened to be one of Bain Capital's biggest competitors in the same field of corporate raiding. I'll make a pun here. It's too rich.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. But do you think Romney's even surprised that they went that route? Because, I mean, that is the pot calling the kettle black.
Oh, it certainly is. I think Romney always knew.
Not black, blah.
Blah. I think Romney is not surprised and by this. You know, desperate times require desperate measures. And it's, you know, the day before a primary election when you're not doing well is a definition of desperate for most candidates. To me, the interesting thing here, you know, is that people say this is good for Obama because it's an attack on Romney, and that's true. But it's better for Obama in a more sort of nuanced way. If you know anything about the Obama campaign, and I'm sure you do and your listeners do too, the thing that they are very keen on is metrics. They study, they study, they study. If you haven't read David Plouffe's book about the 2008 campaign, he was the campaign manager, I highly recommend it. It's just fascinating. You know, there was a lot of hope, there was a lot of poetry in his campaign, but there was a lot of by-the-numbers, you know, on-the-ground reality organizing. And so what they're going to be able to do now, Newt Gingrich's allies, his super PAC in South Carolina, are going to be spending $5 million on a Bain bomb attack against Mitt Romney. I am positive, I'll bet you $10,000, that the Obama campaign will be down in South Carolina and in Florida, if this continues on to Florida, doing focus groups and polling to determine how the Bain attack is playing, whether it's effective, who it's working with, and how might, and if it's not working, how one might make it more effective.
Right.
So they're going to get a laboratory experiment in how to use the Bain criticism against Mitt Romney, courtesy of who? Sheldon Adelson, this casino mogul who's giving Newt Gingrich's super PAC $5 million for this attack. So this is like a gift in that way, not just because they're attacking Romney, because I think he'll survive the attack at this stage of the game.
Right.
It's a $5 million freebie for Barack Obama.
But now that you bring up the $5 million freebie, I mean, shouldn't we be talking at some point about the money that's pervasive throughout politics and how we maybe pull this back to where you're not talking about billionaires like that having so much sway?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, some of us have been writing and complaining about money in politics for 30 years. I don't want to tell you how old I am, but I started at a very early age.
And, 6 or 7.
Yeah, 6 or 7. And, you know, it's one of the biggest uphill political policy battles there seems to be. You know, the public, you know, to be honest here, doesn't get engaged by this stuff. They don't see the direct impact on the pocketbook. They don't see people going off to war because of this. They don't see their friends losing jobs because of this. Now, we all know that it affects everything else because the money in politics affects the policy outcomes from the White House and Congress. So if you want a president who may say, save the auto company, auto industry versus the one who says don't save the auto companies, the money that goes into campaigns might determine that. And all sorts of things, whether we preserve Medicare or Social Security or not.
Right.
So it really is a determinant of everything that comes after the votes are counted. And Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision from last year, opened the floodgates and has made it basically, it's basically taken all restraint off. So anybody with money can find a way to affect any presidential, senatorial, or congressional campaign. And we're going to start seeing some really bad outcomes from this. I think we started seeing it in 2010, midterm elections. It's going to continue to happen, and not until it really pisses people off and they decide that there has to, you know, be legislation. And it's hard to solve this legislatively. There are some legislative solutions, but the Republicans have blocked it in Congress or through a Supreme Court re-review, or even more difficult, a constitutional amendment. I mean, the way to solve this now, I can't kid anybody, is really difficult.
Right.
But we don't have a chance of doing that unless a lot of people start, you know, I don't want to say wake up, that sounds pejorative, unless a lot of people come to the realization that this is important for them to spend time on and to become part of a campaign, a movement. Dylan Radigan on MSNBC is trying to do this. There are a number of advocacy groups out there. I'm sure you can link to them on your website. But we're far from, you know, critical mass.
Right. You know, isn't this the conversation we need to be having, though, especially when you're talking about economics and what kind of an economy we want to have? Do we want to have a Bain capital world, or do we want to have an environment where you're creating jobs that benefit everyone, which you can then take to why the GOP or the GOME, as I've been calling them, have gone on this no rights at work agenda, going after the NLRB, Mitt Romney wanting a right to work nation.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole anti-worker agenda, isn't that part of it?
Well, that is a big part of that. Listen, there is a legitimate policy, ideological, partisan debate to have about the role of unions in this country, about industrial policy, about trade. All those things are things that we as Americans, you know, should feel free to fight about. And if you want to have an anti-union
initiative and have a debate about that in Wisconsin, Michigan, or any place else, as an American, you should be allowed to say, I think unions don't work, and here's why, and you have an honest fight about it. But the problem is when you have something like the Koch brothers, and people have a direct interest in it. And they come in and they flood the zone with money, and they skew the debate with commercials and support for politicians who support them, you don't get that even American debate that the country deserves. And that's, you know, and to me, that's, you know, that's the essence of this. I don't mind being on the losing side of debates. I've been on the losing side of debates.
As long as you
can fight. And if 80% of the public, you know, disagrees, that's the country I live in, you take your loss and you come back to fight another day. But you want it to be a fair fight. Each side, you know, on the union divide here, pro and anti-union, has fought fights in the past to win and lose legislative battles about, you know, workers' rules, union rules, and all that stuff, and that's not going to go away. But you shouldn't let people come in and just put, you know, bags of money on the scales and tip them in one direction. I think that is profoundly anti and un-American. But to get into a place where we can prevent that from happening, as I said earlier, it's going to take a lot of heavy lifting.
Is that a conversation you think that can be had, given the fact that the media in this country seems to be consolidated in the hands of so few?
I don't think the media is the problem. I said it's not in the media.
I'm not saying the media itself, I'm saying the consolidation of the message.
I don't think corporate ownership or consolidation of the media is the issue. I think, you know, look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a great template in a lot of ways. You got people out in the streets, you know, workers, nurses, teachers, neighbors. That was the most important thing. You know, the neighbors of people who were affected.
Sure.
The sense of community there. And, it's a battle that, as you know, hasn't been won fully. You know, it's still ongoing. But it seems, you know, the people power neutralized, or at least not neutralized, was able to fight back against the money power. And you had a fair fight, and it got, you know, you can quibble and you can criticize, but it got the attention it needed, particularly in the local media.
Absolutely.
Which is what you need, right?
But I would argue that all happened because you had an educated populace who understood. The second Walker said, I'm going to call out the National Guard, they thought back to labor education in the schools, and they know. Governor calls out National Guards, workers shot in the back.
And that's the thing, but it was the organizers who got the people out there, got the message out there, and they got, you know, it wasn't just union folk, and it wasn't just people on the left. It was really hard to dismiss that uprising, and people watching it at home across the nation, they looked at those people, and guess what? It looked like America.
Yep.
It looked like America. I've been very encouraged in some ways by Occupy. The Occupy movements, but also I think there's been a cultural element to them that has prevented them from connecting to some people.
Larger audiences,
middle Americans. I don't like using terms like that because they're very generic. But you get the drift.
Right. You know, and that's a conversation again that I think it's an education process, and I'm hoping that continues. Last question tonight, as this comes down, I think Romney's obviously going to win.
The
winner. Where do you see 2 and 3?
You know, if you look, you know, these are the questions I kind of, you know, I like the least. I'm not blaming you because we'll know the answer in a few hours.
Sure.
But if you look at the tracking polls, it seems like, you know, Huntsman is making, you know, steady progress.
And will that help him in South Carolina?
And I think he may get him into second place ahead of Ron Paul. Seems to have a natural ceiling. In South Carolina, you know, it's really hard to see how John Huntsman, you know, leverages this with the type of appeal he has down there. You know, if the argument has been that Mitt Romney's not conservative enough, I don't know if the best alternative to Mitt Romney, and that people are concerned that he's a Mormon, the best alternative to him is a more liberal Mormon. Now, in South Carolina, independents can vote. And Democrats, you have to check me on this, I think Democrats can vote in the Republican primary. And there may be some independents and Democrats who flood the zone for a Huntsman. How much that will help him? I don't know. I don't think he has a lot of the campaign talent or the campaign organization he needs to fully exploit any boomlet from New Hampshire.
All right, David Corn, it's great talking with you from Mother Jones and MSEC. Thanks a lot. I look forward to talking to you again at some point.
Okay, thank you, Rick.
All right, let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
A bipartisan majority in Washington has been quietly funding a multi-million dollar educational initiative to lift people up. Great! Except that the initiative is not for hard-hit Americans, but for Afghanistan. Actually, only top Afghan officials can participate and get ready to upchuck. This so-called educational effort is to teach the corrupt leaders of President Hamid Karzai's regime the art of public relations. Specifically, how to hold news conferences. How's that going, you ask? Not well. Though in fairness, let's acknowledge that Karzai's officials have at least begun to hold a few actual press meetings. Previously, Afghan ministries required the media to submit any questions by fax, which was a bit of a runaround since they had no working fax machines. So, this is counted as a giant step forward. Now, though, U.S. instructors have abruptly withdrawn from the PR school. Apparently, they're annoyed that Karzai and his cohorts keep criticizing and frustrating our efforts to help them establish a functioning government. Last year, for example, the Afghan Attorney General expelled American advisors from his office after they kept pushing him to prosecute cases of blatant corruption against his fellow officials. Still, while our advisors, instructors, and mentors have been pulled, our money has not. American financing of the PR school continues. It's all part of our $8 billion tax dollars a month, that Washington keeps airlifting into Afghanistan, while our own people's educational and job training needs are being slashed. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, at least Obama is getting us out of Afghanistan in 2014, right? Well, he says so, but Pentagon war hawks say they want to negotiate with Karzai to keep thousands of American forces there and billions more of our tax dollars beyond Obama's deadline.
If you'd like more of Jim Hightower's real populism, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter gives you the real lowdown on which corporations, by name, are doing what to the middle class, our environment, and our democracy. Each month, the Hightower Lowdown brings you facts you didn't know, along with actions you can take to fight back. It also comes with a sense of humor. Hightower believes we can fight the gods and still have fun. Plus, get this, it's cheap. Only $15 brings you 12 issues a year. For real populism, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Walker is Mubarak, Madison, Cairo, fascism track, next stop Ohio. Trying to kill labor, that's their jihad, huh? What's gonna happen when the people all rise up? Sad thing is, so if we all labor, what you expect to hear? Billionaires on the papers.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. We are live here in the Radisson Hotel, Manchester, New Hampshire. Talk Radio News Services, Radio Row. I am having the absolute best time. But I guess it's all been decided. Thanks to Grandpa the Psychic Spider Monkey, who is located at the Staten Island Zoo. He has chosen, through which banana he liked best, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, John Huntsman, Rick Perry, and Mitt Romney in that order. So the Spider Monkey hath spoken. Well, I guess just as well as voting with some of the people I've talked to here in the area. I've got John Nichols from The Nation here. John, it seems like we run into each other everywhere I go.
It's because some of us just go to find it, you know, where the action is. And I want to tell you without any doubt, I'm literally, for your listeners, I'm sitting, you know, what is it, 12 feet from Rick Santorum?
Yep.
This is where the action is.
Yeah, there he is. He won't come to our show.
And I will ask me any question. I'll give you the Rick Santorum answer.
Should gays be in the military?
No.
Should we have manufacturing that creates union jobs?
No.
Should we have education for all students across the country?
No.
Should we have health care for everyone?
No.
Well, sure.
Am I going to be president? No.
And that is the important question here.
Yeah, I'm really here for this action, though. Look at this.
Buddy, yeah, we talked to Buddy not too long ago. What do you think of Buddy Romer?
I love Buddy Romer.
I got to tell you, my problem with him is his hatred of teachers.
Well, you know, look, I'm sorry. If you're going to actually start to be precise about these things, we have a problem with the entire Republican field.
I do.
Because they all have a tripwire in them.
Absolutely.
You know, I love...
Just a tripwire?
Well, some more than others.
Okay.
Right? I love Ron Paul talking about declaring wars and obeying the Constitution. I think, yeah, I really, and I think he's genuine. I know there's some on the left who are like, oh, you know, he's crazy. No, when he gets on that stuff, he sounds great. I wish I had more lefties that would talk that way.
Yeah, what I find is a lot of the Paulians, the little Paul bots, are the anti-war lefties.
They really are. So I dig that. And, you know, and I can even get a little bit minimally energized when Rick Santorum starts to talk about bringing manufacturing jobs back to America.
Right.
It's just a bad idea for how to do it, but a good goal. And with Buddy Romer, you know, I think the truth on Buddy Romer is this. He's probably, of all of them, closer to something I could stomach than the rest.
Right.
You know, with all due respect, campaigns at Occupy rally, at Occupy events. And the other thing about Buddy Romer is
they'll listen to him.
Yeah, anybody. Yeah. He's talking about money and politics,
yep.
And it's true. And he's pretty good on some trade stuff. You know, he's got a little bit going on there. So, you know, I mean, look, but in my opinion, it's sort of like going to the demolition derby, right?
Yep.
You may have a favorite car. But really, you're just kind of interested in, you know, watching them bang into each other.
Sure.
And I like Buddy Romer because, in my opinion, he has one of the better kind of – he's got a classic demolition derby M.O. He has taken the crappiest car in town, right?
That he has.
And he's parked down at the end of the row hoping that the other cars will crash into each other so he can, like, wade in and be noticed at the end and maybe get the girl to drive home with him after the derby.
And I like him because he's fun.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And here's the commitment that Buddy Romer has made to me. And I'm holding him to it. He has said he's sticking in this race till Wisconsin because Wisconsin's primary happens to coincide with local elections. And, you know, there's going to be a need to get labor and progressive people out to vote, you know. And I think we may have to gin up a little Buddy Romer campaign there to, you know, give people an alternative to Mitt Romney.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Being Wisconsin, I know they've got the signatures.
They do.
I'm sure that's going to happen. Do you see him being recalled if he's
yes.
if he's not indicted first?
Yeah, it's a race there, you know. And I frankly, I hope he doesn't get indicted first. I want the people to take care of this job.
Because then what happens, in my opinion, if he's indicted, Cleve Flanger or
Cleefish.
Yeah,
she might rise from
she
the
may end up,
from the grave.
And I don't
yeah.
think there's as much venom and as much disdain against her.
Well, they don't even know who she is.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, but look, here's the other part of it. I actually am a genuine small D Democrat. I believe in this concept that people ought to rule. And so I used to have friends back when I was very strongly advocating for impeaching George Bush and Dick Cheney. I'd have people say, well, shouldn't they be tried by the world court? I'd say, no, they shouldn't be. We, the people, ought to impeach them through our Congress, through our elected officials, because it's our job.
Right.
That's what we should do. Similarly, in Wisconsin, I do hear people saying, well, you know, Walker's in so much trouble. This investigation's getting closer and closer to him, you know, taking down very close aides, FBI raids on his top appointees, his press secretary taking immunity in a John Doe investigation. This thing's coming fast toward the governor. But I do not want a legal, you know, loophole to be the footnote on the end of Scott Walker's story. I want it to be a story of a genuine small R revolution,
yep,
where people come up, they take their democracy back, schedule an election, and remove an anti-labor governor. That's the message I want to have go across America. And I have to tell you, as I watch the circumstance on the ground, I think that's coming. I believe they will have in the range of 800, maybe 900,000 signatures.
Wow.
Which is unprecedented. You realize that Wisconsin's half the size of Ohio. And so Ohio got 1.3 million. If Wisconsin gets 800,000, that'd be the equivalent of Ohio getting almost 2 million.
Yeah.
So it's big, big numbers.
That's
really
impressive.
A huge proportion gotten out of rural counties, small towns. There are several counties that where more signatures have been gathered than voted for Walker when he won those counties.
Wow.
So
see, now that's something that I think is important to point out, because one of the things that I think has gone on in this country is we've allowed a small number of voters to decide what goes on.
Yeah.
Because you're not having that kind of participation.
Right. And the recall has got an energy level that just knocks it out of the park. I will guarantee you that the percentage of people who vote after this incredible festivity here in New Hampshire, percentage of New Hampshire voters who come out and cast their ballot will be dramatically smaller than the percentage of Wisconsinites who come and vote in April or May in the recall election.
In a primary that is going to be over.
Yeah. Yeah, this is wall to wall, you know, and Wisconsin will get a good deal of coverage, but it won't be the same. but it will mean more, and it will mean more for this reason. We have a problem in America with a Republican Party that is now the most militantly anti-labor party, not just in the history of the United States. I think we're actually taking on a lot of, you know, countries around the world for having this level of venom toward working people. And it just on display in the debates, on display in their campaign. Romney actually, one of the first times in history where somebody's cut an anti, you know, right, union ad on TV.
Yep, rights agenda to the next level.
So they've really pushed it to a level that it's never been at. We have a Democratic Party that can barely muster itself in a lot of cases to defend workers' rights. Yep. And so to have a state, a battleground state up on the northern tier of the United States say, no, 2 years ago we made the horrible mistake of electing an anti-labor governor. We're going to pop him out of office. He's gone. That message to Democrats, as well as to Republicans, is about, I would argue, the most important message that will come this year.
Let me ask you this, John, because, you know, I've been talking to a number of the Republican legislators, especially here in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. about their no rights at work agenda. Mm-hmm. And what's painfully apparent to me is they don't have a clue of what right to work actually is.
No.
They cannot articulate why they support it, and they in no way can defend it.
Yeah. Look, right to work is it's sort of a dinosaur that was dying down in some southern states, you know, because let's go to the core.
Are there any rights? Is there any work?
No. The core of right to work is that we should always remember why it came into being. In 1945, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, a militant grouping of unions in steel, auto, and others, decided to march south. And they created Operation Dixie. It was a campaign to organize black and white workers in southern states. And the goal was not merely to organize the plants, but it was to change the politics of the South so that segregation and discrimination would be wiped away from that region. It was a glorious and wonderful initiative. And what happened? Republicans combined with Southern Democrats to pass right-to-work laws in 1946, barely a year later, with the purpose of preventing unions from getting blacks and whites together in the South. That was what it was all about. Right to work exists for no other reason than that. And the southern states swept it in. Northern states rejected it. And you look back over the last 70 years, better part of 70 years, which states had better growth, better, you know, progress economically, it is the northern states, the ones that rejected the racist policy of right to work.
And the division. I mean, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, the wealth class has really done a masterful job of dividing us. So
yeah.
If you look at the states that where people had the right to organize, mm-hmm. they got more of the pie, and they created more opportunities for others.
Even today, they are more prosperous. This is the amazing thing. People that say, well, the South is booming. The South is not booming. The South is at the bottom of a race to the bottom.
Well,
right?
Let me ask you, because mm-hmm. I had a number of Rick Perry supporters sit here and tell me, he's created jobs.
Yeah,
and granted, they have the second highest number of minimum wage jobs in the country as a percentage. Is that the economy we want?
No, this is an interesting thing because, you know, the White House tomorrow is going to have a forum on manufacturing, insourcing, you know, whatever the hell that is. And I'm for it, I think. But here's the problem. President Obama is very excited because we have a little bit of a bump in manufacturing. We're doing a little better. I'm excited by that, too. I want us to have more manufacturing in America. But I always ask, what's the quality of our manufacturing? Before the Bush downturn of 2008, we had the better part of a million people working in the auto industry. By 2009, it was down to under 700,000. So we had 300,000 people, mostly in unionized quality jobs, you know, kind of pushed out of the game.
That's because of the union, of course.
It had nothing to do with the union. It had everything to do with, you know, a bad downturn. When we bailed out the auto industry in the United States, you know, a lot of people say, we revitalized the auto industry. No, we helped the auto industry to stay, keep its names in place. But many of those auto companies opened plants in Mexico and China. So the fact of the matter is that even now, auto employment, while up a bit, is not restored
not back
to where
it was
in 2007.
Right.
This is where I go to always. I want millions of unionized jobs in industrial and even modernized industrial settings. I want people to be retrained. I want skilled workers. But I want those people to have union protection, union wages, union benefits, because that's a vital part of this thing. And so I'm not satisfied simply with the renewal of manufacturing, although I'm glad to have the jobs come. But I want that next stage. I want those jobs to be quality jobs with good pay, good benefits, and a future.
Absolutely.
And so, look, when you get down to the core of it, right to work is, I can tell you this bottom line, fundamental reality of a right-to-work state. Right-to-work state is like a stop on the interstate right before you get to your hometown. Sometimes you really have to go to the bathroom. You pull over, use the rest stop. But then you get back in, you head toward where you're going. Well, the fact of the matter is, for multinational corporations that start this process of leaving industrialized northern states, then they go to a middle-south state, then they go to a southern state, then they go to Mexico, then they go to China. And then they abandon China and try to find out if they can set up a shop in Burma.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's the reality
of
what right-to-work
is. That's an excellent analogy.
Yeah.
Because the company, and those are the companies I don't think we want.
Well, I want them, but I want them to operate by different rules.
But isn't that our fault? Isn't that the fault of our government, our citizens,
yes,
for allowing that to happen? These trade policies that benefit multinationals
what,
over
if
workers?
If you came and proposed this policy in Germany, which, by the way, is a better economic circuit, if you propose this to the most conservative economic players in Germany, they would run you out of the room.
They'd say
you are nuts. You're crazy.
Yeah, I mean, in Germany, I had just done a comparison between the German auto workers and the American auto workers.
They're paid more.
They're paid much more, and they produce much more.
Yeah, and they produce the cars that are considered to be the elite cars of the world. Now,
but the reason they do that is because they don't have this butting head adversarial relationship. I can't have a conversation with any Republican about a union without talking about, well, it's the union who wants to run the company. It's
what's
not
happened
that at
is
all.
There's a sickness that has come into the Republican Party. And if you were to replace the word union and union member with African-American community and black, it would be considered to be the most viciously racist stuff you had ever heard. They will talk about unions and union
members.
Oh, it's just, no, but it's just
thugs.
It drips with venom. And you ask yourself, where did this come from? When Ronald Reagan, no great friend of unions, said to the Carpenters Union Convention in 1981 that Americans have a sacred right to collective bargaining. When he said that collective bargaining has been central to all of the progress in the modern United States. Ronald Reagan said that. But
you're messing with the deity. Don't talk bad about the deity.
Look at Reagan's quotes on unions. Even when he was fighting with PATCO, he didn't like public sector unions. I disagree with him on that. But he went to the Carpenters Union Convention in September 1981 and gave one of the most pro-union speeches you've ever heard. Now, in the Republican Party, barely 30 years later, that party reserves its ultimate venom for trade unionism. Why is that? It is not because anything changed the American people. The polling on American people shows they like unions more now than they did 30 years ago.
And that was going to be my last question for you. This agenda that they've pursued, this no rights at work agenda, you know, as a Teamster for 20 years, I would say about half of the people that I worked with were Republicans because they were making, thought, I'm making a good living. The Republicans are talking the talk. I'm
going to
keep
boat,
my
got
money.
A cottage.
All that stuff. I'm in the investor class. I'm in the wealth class. Do you think now the Republicans are going to lose that working class voter, that union voter, who now sees a party who despises them?
They have. It has happened in some states where the issues have come to the head. In Wisconsin, between the time that Scott Walker was inaugurated, having won 37% of the union household vote, to a month after he did his attack on public sector unions, the support level for Walker had, among union households, had dropped in half. Went from 37 to 19.
Wow.
And so that was a dramatic shift right there. In Ohio, we saw a similar pattern where the polling showed a dramatic shift in union households. So where it comes to a head, people get it. It will happen in Indiana where they're doing the right to work fight. These things will be real. Whether it goes national is a bigger question. It falls in two directions. One, will Barack Obama really step up
and
make
speak
a pro-union message? If he does, he can reap a lot of benefits. The other way, unfortunately, is if a Mitt Romney did become president and try a national right to work, then you would see people get it all over the country very, very quickly. Unfortunately, that's sort of the dynamic we have. Either the Democratic Party steps up and puts the message out, or we must wait for these Wisconsin, Ohio-type situations where it gets so bad that people wake up. Bottom line, though, is given the choice, when we have clarity on these issues, as Ohio did, look at that, 61% of Ohioans, 83 of 88 counties, including John Boehner's home congressional district, voting to defend collective bargaining rights.
That's remarkable, especially when you look at Ohio, the southern end of it.
Not exactly a liberal bastion.
Not at all. John Nichols, always great talking with you. I look forward to seeing you again at the next function we attend.
Well, when we occupy the Capitol.
There you go. John Nichols from The Nation. Quick break, right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Drowning in crafted lies to save the USA and resume the size of mine. Stop taking my-
day and shipping it offshore. Do the job and you're in the good
form. Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Berg.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, you can take the program on the go. We are here in Manchester, New Hampshire. Today is decision day. How will the voters of Massachusetts, of New Hampshire, decide who's going to be the guy to carry on? Who's going to be their choice? Romney, obvious choice. Who's going to be 2, 3? And then the question is, you know, you've got a lot of second tier folks who've come out because, you know what, they want to push their ideas, they want to push their thoughts. And I'm sitting here with Christopher Hill. He is running for president as a Republican, correct?
That's right. I'm on the Republican ballot.
Why, Chris? I mean, at the end of this, you look at the fact that you've got the big five who are out there now, the millions of dollars that they're spending, the organization that they've got. Why?
I'm an airline captain. I'm a former fighter pilot from Desert Storm with 50 combat missions 20 years ago. And as veterans, we protected this nation for decades around the world. And as we did that, all we ever asked of politicians in Washington, D.C. was to do a good job and pass on a stronger and better nation for our children and grandchildren. And over the last 30 years especially, those professional career politicians have failed America. And so we're stepping up to the plate. If we could take one veteran from every state and take the White House, we could put this country back on track, not just for the rich on Wall Street, but for every person in America, because as an officer in the Air Force, I served all Americans, not just the rich or the poor, black, white, men, women, Republican or Democrat. So that's what we're doing this for.
You know, I think that's something that all Americans can agree on, that we should be taking care of the people that we call heroes. You look at the folks who cleaned up after 9/11, the people who ran into those buildings, the people who serve our country. For too often, they become props. We put the hero title on them, but after we're done with them, we just kind of set them aside. And I go back to my childhood. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. And I remember as a kid those men coming back from Vietnam, basically just dumped back into our town. no help from the government, no help from anyone, with horrible drug and alcohol problems, horrible disfigurements, broken minds, broken bodies. And I prayed that we wouldn't see that happen again. But sadly, I think that is exactly what's going on.
Well, let me give you a quick story from my campaigning. I've been up here for 5 months. I've been out there on the trail with Rick Santorum. I've been out there with Mitt Romney, Herman Cain at the time, and Ron Paul. Back on Veterans Day, I was at a house here in Manchester called Liberty House. It's a home for homeless veterans. They only have enough space for 10. I asked them what they do when they have a waiting list. They have a waiting list of 30 at the current time. They said, we buy tents and sleeping bags and let them sleep out back. And in January and February in New Hampshire, when the weather drops below zero, they'll cycle them in 5 at a time and let them sleep on the floor at Liberty House in Manchester, New Hampshire. Now, at the same time, I ran into a person who came up and said, let me tell you what I do. I investigate drug production as an undercover agent across this country. And he said, at the same time, right now I'm investigating a gang that's producing meth. And at the same time they're producing meth, they're collecting disability checks from our government. And so I'm not into the politics like many of the Republican candidates are. I'm into a system that is broken. The tax system in this country is broken when you've got a corporation like GE that makes $5 billion and doesn't pay a penny in taxes, and the middle class is being destroyed in this nation. We've got a spending system that's out of control with fraud. We've got an aristocracy in Washington, D.C., where we have 30- and 40-year congressmen in place, and they are the problem. We need term limits for Congress, and that'll begin to restore what looks like America again.
So as I'm talking to you, my mind is going through, what exactly is it that draws you to the Republican Party?
Well, I started off in 1980 working for Ronald Reagan, and back in those
days... This is not the party of Ronald Reagan.
That's right. This isn't the party of Ronald Reagan, and the Democratic Party is not the party of Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy. It's changed a lot. They both polarized to each side, and that's what I think veterans offer America. We go into this looking at what needs to be done for this country with a mission for America, and at my website, Hill, H-I-L-L, hill2012.com, you can read about it. It's straightforward, and I back everything up with videos. When I talk about a tax system that's broken, I put videos on there of Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner, who didn't pay his taxes, Charlie Rangel, who was head of the Tax Ways and Means Committee, who had $600,000 of undeclared income and didn't pay his taxes. Over and over again, the stories are the same. An aristocracy where you got Ron Paul serving so long in Congress that he's joined by his son Rand, now in the U.S. Senate from Kentucky. And we have families going to Washington, D.C. to run this nation. That was never the way this was designed.
If I can point out real quick, there was a president and a son. President, if we remember the Adams. So just to kind of clarify that.
Okay.
just real quick.
I'm with you.
Again, the website, hill2012.com. We will get a link at therickssmithshow.com. You know, I'm talking to a lot of folks here, a lot of Republican candidates and their surrogates. And to me, at this point, I could not support the Republican Party on the fact that I'm a labor guy.
Right.
You know, I give credit to the Teamsters Union for the fact that I was, through collective bargaining, able to benefit from hard work, and I was compensated well for that. I live in a very good neighborhood. I've done very well because the work I've done has been well compensated. I look at this party with a no rights at work agenda. Got Romney saying he runs right to work nation. I say, how can you, as an airline pilot, be party to that?
Because, like you said, this party today doesn't reflect the party of Reagan. Reagan used to be president of the Screen Actors Guild, I believe, back in the day, and he was a Democrat. And so there was a time when we came together as a nation. Now, let me give you my background really quick.
Okay.
I am a member of a union, and the company that I do work for is one of the largest transportation companies, and there is a great model out there of a private company that takes very good care of its people. They ask that we do a good job for them, and we do. And they compensate us very well, and we have terrific benefits. But I think where we're getting into trouble in this country is when we're moving into the public sector of unionizing everybody. When I served in the military, it was very specific that we couldn't align ourselves with political parties or with a union. And there was a reason for that, because they didn't want us to be taken care of in a way that would put an allegiance to a certain party over all Americans. And I think we've gone down the road for a number of years now where you see a cycle in the public sector
where union employees are specifically kicking back their support and donations to one particular party.
The party that supports them.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And so what we need to do is, if you're a policeman or a fireman, I can't imagine for a minute that your allegiance would not be to your entire town and would be more to one political party. So that's something that we have to take a look at down the road. But I am firmly a union person.
Good.
And I can say that out of any Republican up here, I'll bet you I'm the only one that stood with my Teamster brothers and sisters back in 1997 when we had a two-week event at the company that we worked for. And so, you know, you need to take a look at the website and you need to get past this, because both parties,
they play us
on each side.
I want people to take back the Republican Party. I want to go back to a time where a statement like anyone who would talk about doing away with the Farm Bill or labor unions or doing away with Social Security would never be heard from again.
Well, instead of looking at doing away with things, why don't we look at it from a common sense standpoint? I was in Oakland, California about 6 weeks ago on an airline trip. I'm still working. I don't do this full time.
Right.
And so I was on an airline trip in Oakland before it turned violent, and I went to Occupy Wall Street in Oakland. And I have to say, I walked around there and met with a lot of people and talked to a lot of them about what their opinions were. And there were some that were off the deep end about a number of things.
We're going to get that in any crowd.
Exactly. And you have that right here in some of the lesser-known candidates, I have to say. But from that standpoint, I met one gentleman who was in his mid-40s, and he said, you know what, Chris? I was a 20-year machinist in this country, and my job was shipped overseas to China. And I'll never have that level of income or job security again the rest of my life. And I understand that. That happened with NAFTA. It began with NAFTA. And that was a combination of George H. W. Bush, a Republican, and Bill Clinton. Yep. On my website, I specifically put a wiki comment there when Clinton signed NAFTA that said, this means jobs for Americans and good-paying jobs, and I'm quoting him here. He said, if I didn't think so, I wouldn't sign this. And yet, I fly trips down to Monterrey, Mexico all the time, and when I'm in the hotel in Monterrey, Mexico, it's filled with American citizens who are there working. And I ask, hey, guys, what are you guys doing down here? And they say, hell, we're down here with Maytag, because they moved the company down here years ago.
Yeah.
That's what we've got to fix in this country. We have to bring the jobs back to America, and we have to step up as Americans and say we're willing to pay a little bit more for our American brothers and sisters to have good-paying jobs right here in this country.
I'm about to fall out of my chair. Please, take that downstairs. Take that to the rest of your party. Take back your party, please. Because the quote I said about doing away with Social Security or doing away with unions and doing away with the Farm Bill, that was Dwight David Eisenhower saying anytime you that doesn't happen in this era. I'd like to go back to that.
Well, you know, I started this whole process actually on the road here 5 months ago. August 20th, I spoke at my very first event with Herman Cain at the time, okay? And what I found in this process is we all talk about taking the money out of politics. They start off defining you if you're a viable candidate, whether or not you've raised $250,000. And I'd like to say, when was I not viable when I was flying F-15 Strike Eagles in Desert Storm? When was I not viable when I was delivering Christmas for you 3 weeks ago? So the bottom line is, as human beings with equal passion and equally good ideas for this country, we can't continue to let the parties exclude all of us who do what we need to do for this nation.
Outstanding. Christopher Hill, I appreciate your time, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck. I suggest you take a look at AmericansElect.org.
I'll take a look at that.
There might be an opportunity to get your name out there and start, because this is an agenda. What you've laid out, what you've told me so far, I'm right there with you.
It's down the middle of the road, so I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Chris Hill, the website, hill2012.com. Quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law.
It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Mo was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
To the Rick Smith Show. Come and check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the podcast is there on the website. Or you, if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and you can take the program on the go. And, you know, I look at the guy that we just talked to, this Christopher Hill. And again, the website, Hill2012.com. Exactly what I've been saying for the longest time. Republicans, take back your party. Get away from the divisiveness. This extremism that has gripped this party is destroying the nation. This whole no rights at work agenda, I think, is going to turn around and bite them right in the behind. And it should, because, you know, I go back to the Eisenhower days. When Eisenhower said any politician who would go out of the farm bill or Social Security or labor unions would not be heard again in this country. Their numbers are minimal and they're stupid. How in just the time from then till now have we come to a place where a worker's right to collective bargaining is under such attack? And in the mainstream, where you have a mainstream party who is hell-bent on, and again, the small government party, the party that says government should stay out of your lives, government shouldn't be intrusive, telling me that I can't negotiate with my employer and that we cannot come to some agreement, seems very, very anti their party. So, again, we are here in the Manchester, New Hampshire, Radisson Hotel. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We cannot take phone calls here, so I apologize for that. We will be back in the studio tomorrow. Our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, will be sitting in along with Dr. Steven Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. They'll be taking over because it's our travel day back. We'll be back live in the studio on Thursday. So much to talk about, so much to get into, especially when you look at Romney's, the attacks on Romney. I think it's going to be a bloodbath in South Carolina over this Bain Capital thing. So, again, I'm excited because I think this is the thing that's going to tear him down, and it's a discussion that needs to be had. Look, what kind of an economy do we want? Do we want the Romney economy? Because remember what his housing bill is. Let everyone collapse and the vultures come in. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In the front, spirit of joy, hungry jungle hunters with one on planet eye.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Indiana's GOP-controlled legislature is holding a hearing on the proposed anti-union so-called right-to-work bill today. Despite being outgunned by big Republican majorities, the Indiana AFL-CIO's Jeff Harris says there's a fighting chance of defeating the bill. Harris says it's unpopular with Hoosiers, including some Republicans.
Right now, we have a surprising number of allies on the Republican side who either are vehemently opposed to the concept of right to work or don't like the strong arm tactics that the leadership is using to pass this bill. So we are still very hopeful, cautiously optimistic about our chances to defeat this bill.
Thousands of Indiana citizens opposed to the right to work bill have protested at the state capitol. For the first time since 2009, federal employees could see a small pay raise in 2013. Jesse Russell reports.
President Barack Obama is proposing a 0.5% pay increase for federal employees in his 2013 budget. Republican proposals have called for a one-year extension on a freeze for federal worker pay increases. During the recent pay freeze, workers have continued to receive within-grade step increases, but some of the proposals from Republicans even call for an end to those pay increases. Even if Obama's proposal makes it through the House of Representatives, it is much less than the increase in private sector earnings, which increased by 2% in 2011.
A financial transaction tax is the first step in healing America. Sign our petition at protestintheusa.org.
National Nurses United is pressing for a financial transactions tax on Wall Street as a concrete way to help heal our economy. The Nurses Union says a new report from University of Amherst economists Robert Polin and James Heinz shows that a robust tax on Wall Street transactions would generate significant revenue. National Nurses United says with so many Americans still struggling to recover from the Wall Street Great Recession of 2008, we need a meaningful way to heal our nation. The union says a small tax on major financial trading, which is currently untaxed, is a critical first step. An anti-union group's class action lawsuit attacking the ability of unions to finance political battles is scheduled to be heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. The suit filed by the National Right to Work Foundation was filed after SEIU used a special assessment in 2005 to raise money from SEIU members to fight anti-union California ballot proposals. The suit is part of an ongoing national campaign to destroy the political power of workers and their unions by trying to cut off the money needed for workers to effectively fight political attacks. Oral arguments in the case are being heard today by the U.S. Supreme Court. This newscast was made possible in part by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S., Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
What Dennis Kucinich just said right there. How can you say you're for workers and not be for them having rights? Just mind-blowing. Every one of these candidates and every one of their surrogates, oh, we're going to create jobs, like Rick Perry did down in Texas. All minimum wage jobs. Do we want to live in minimum wage nation? I sure hope not. I sure hope there's a better vision for this country. And I think back to my grandfather's generation who fought, bled, and died not only in World War II, but in the workplace for a better tomorrow for their kids and their grandkids. Thinking forward, vision forward. Amazing stuff. I've got David Lawton. He is the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Secretary Treasurer, Director of the Brewery and Soft Drink Conference. David, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
You know, I look at what's going on here in Manchester. Pretty much an amazing event of really way out ideologues. They really have no problem telling me how much they don't like workers.
They're certainly not shy about it. I mean, each candidate has basically said it's time to get rid of the union. We need right to work, and you need it here in New Hampshire, which couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, if you measure things as to what's good for the state and so forth, think about what's happening here in New Hampshire. Think about the fact that New Hampshire's been the fastest-growing state in New England. No sales tax, no income tax, a very high per capita income, I think ninth in the country, and things are going great here. And guess what? There's a union here, there's a number of unions here, and we're working hard to protect and preserve what we have and make sure our members have a quality of life that every American should have, the opportunity to work, the opportunity to have a home. Imagine, and even put your kids through college. I mean, isn't that an awful lot to ask? And
or maybe take a day off and have a vacation.
Yeah, I know. It's just incredible that they'll stand there and talk about right to work, for example, when they really don't even understand it. They truly do not understand the concept. First of all, as Teamsters, none of our dues money goes to any political action. There isn't a dime of our dues money that goes to the political action. You know, any money that's raised for political action is totally independent by people. And that's like a dollar here and $2 there. It's not an open war chest where you can write a check and you don't even have to tell people that you wrote the check and who you wrote it for.
20 years, $2 a week into the drive fund. You know, all the year, because I believe in having a representative. And I think that's what a lot of people seem to forget. Their unions represent them not just at the bargaining table, but also in the political realm as well, watching out for their interests, fighting against insane trade agreements that ship jobs overseas, like the latest one that just came out. It's nuts to me that we pass a free trade agreement with 35% domestic content requirement when Europe got 55%.
Yeah, you know what's funny, that some of the people are missing here that are supposedly the smartest people out there running for president is the fact that a third of our membership is Republican, and all they're doing is upsetting that third of the membership. They're very happy with their jobs, and they're happy paying their dues. And you know, the misnomer that you have to join the union. You know, and I know, that's not true. You don't want to take the oath that some of us have taken. You don't have to take that oath.
Nope.
You don't want to pay. You want to pay a core fee? You can pay a core fee. Just think, if you and I decided that we're at a point in time in our life where our children are up and gone and so forth, and we don't think that we should be paying for example, the taxes for school.
Although
because we have no kids in school.
That's what they want.
You know? I mean, come on.
But that's the world they want to live in. They want to live. They've defined freedom as themselves. It's only about me. We're in a hotel over here in Manchester where all the Paul bots come in. All these Ron Paul supporters. And to them, freedom means they can dump their soda on the floor and they can throw their trash everywhere and they can destroy things. To them, that's freedom. They don't think about the worker who's going to have to come and clean the mess up that they make or the problems that they've created behind them.
Oh, I know. I know. And it's going to be interesting as time marches on with this whole campaign. Interestingly enough, I mean, we're seeing them fighting amongst themselves like I've never seen them fight before.
That's beautiful.
And, you know, I mean,
especially talking about Romney and Bain Capital. I mean, for people who've been around a while, lived through the 80s and 90s, as I'm sure you did, watched these equity funds come in and take profitable companies, steal their pension funds, suck them dry of assets, and then cut them off to die just so they could make a little bit more. That's something that needs to be talked about, examined, and pointed fingers at who's done it.
Sure, we're seeing that happen day in and day out with the equity company. What's happening with good businesses becoming, you know, leverage buyouts and so forth. I mean, you know, the problems in this country, why is it always put back on the workers' back? I mean, the banking industry that destroyed the home industry. And then, you know, we bail them out. and then somebody talks about the ills of helping the auto industry that helps so many people, so many different businesses, and they're back up and running and doing well. Wouldn't you think that it would be great if we could bring a lot of the other industries back to this country and have them do well and profit?
The day the collapse happened, I said the first thing I said in September of 2008, and I can get the audio, is we need to make the people at the bottom whole. Don't bail out the bankers at top. Make all those people at the bottom whole. It will then funnel its way back up. They'll be taken care of, but we are not going to have a situation where now you have millions of families out in the streets and communities falling because you've got abandoned homes in all these communities.
Here's how ridiculous it gets. I mean, here in the state, the legislation in again this year. We were able to defeat it last year. But it's in again for classification of employees. Now, as Teamsters, we represent a diverse group. We represent the custodian, the bus driver, the school principals, police departments, guards in the prisons, truck drivers, brewery workers.
Workers.
I mean, on and on and on it goes. There isn't anybody that we won't help that needs help out there, okay? Now, take for example, the bus drivers. They want to reclassify bus drivers in this state, school bus drivers, as seasonal employees. The majority of the bus drivers are single moms coming out to work to make a living, to provide for their kids. Because when they get those jobs, they have the opportunity for health care. So guess what? They're not on welfare, they're not getting their food stamps, and they're putting a roof over their head. And now what they want to do is classify them as seasonal employees, so when they're laid off in the summer, they don't want them to draw unemployment. Now, what kind of rationale is that?
Those are family values, David. Good, solid family values.
You know, it's time for people to think about things like that. It's incredible. The fact that they really don't want to have the public sector employees have the right to organize and have a union. I mean, you could do that in a lot of third world countries. You're not going to be able to do it here in New Hampshire.
It's amazing to me. I mean, you said a minute ago that, you know, this is one of the fastest growing economies in the Northeast. And, you know, I look at that and I say, you know, compare what you're doing here to what they're doing down in Texas. Minimum wage versus having the opportunity to grow and to make decent wages because you have the ability of collective bargaining. So I look at this, and again, you know, you go back to the Rick Perrys, you go back to the Romneys, Right to Work Nation, all of this stealing my rights away. I mean, I would rather follow your model. Let's grow this economy, but let's do it together.
You even had employers testifying. Why are you interfering? I thought you were about less government. Why are you interfering between a relationship that works well with the company, the union, and the workers? The workers make the ultimate decision, not the leadership of a local union. It's democracy. They voted. This is the way they want it.
But they're not the Democracy Party. They're a very totalitarian party.
It's becoming very evident, but you know what? It's becoming more evident to more people in this state, which may be
That's
a very positive for all of us as union workers and union leaders.
That is my hope. The hope is that, you know, as this thing plays out, people start to become keenly aware of the direction they want to take us. Because all of these attacks, all of these assaults have reaped no new ideas. Their economic plans are the same failed plans that got us into this mess in the first place. So they've got to disguise it in a certain way, which is diversion, which is bread and circus, which is, hey, look over here. Because maybe you know something I don't, but their economic plans, their plans to pull us out of this recession is, well, more tax cuts for wealthy people, more deregulation so we can have crummy environment. It doesn't make sense to me.
You know, when you can have some of the wealthiest people in the world even identify with it, like a Warren Buffett saying, you know, that we can afford to pay more, the rich can afford to pay more, and yet you keep hearing this all the time. They want the cuts, and the people get nothing. I mean, you're going to look at some of the other countries and the problems they're having as a result of taking the middle class away. You eliminate the middle class, that's what this country needs is a middle class. And you know what? The people who are striving to get there, they're trying to defeat that. The facts are the facts.
Absolutely.
The right to work states that people are absolutely working for less money.
Absolutely.
Is that what it's about?
To them, yes. It's a race to the bottom. We just talked to a guy, what are your representatives? A guy named Al Bellisario. Belladisaro or whatever. And he was, you know, we're going to compete with China. They have to pay those union wages, so we're forcing them to leave the country because they want to make a living and maybe have health care and maybe some retirement security and maybe a voice and maybe some say. We're forcing them out of the country, David. See, you personally are forcing those people out of this country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're forcing them out, really. I mean, I welcome them all in.
But isn't that the argument that they're making? You know, you look at Bethlehem Steel. If I wish I had a nickel for every time someone said that the union forced Bethlehem Steel out of business. Not the fact that Bethlehem Steel invested in hotels and golf courses and had lavish CEO pay and all. Had nothing to do with that and didn't invest in their business. It was those union workers who wanted to make a living.
You know, you talk to the employers where we have them organized, and I'm going to tell you, the overwhelming majority of those employers will tell you that they're happy with the way it is working with us, that there aren't labor strikes. I mean, we have relatively few strikes around here. It just doesn't happen because you know what we do that, you know what we do that they can't do? We can compromise.
There you go.
We can do when things are good, we can share the good. When things are bad, guess what? We're there when it's bad too. To help out. And we've proven that over and over again.
And that's the question I keep asking these people. Why do you not want to sit down and talk? Why is it you think you have the right to impose something on me? And that's what it comes down to. They don't want to negotiate. They want to impose.
You know, one of the CEOs in this country of a very large company recently said that he'd owed a Republican, who's always given to the party and so forth, made the comment that, guess what? I pay my workers well. They have great benefits. You know what? They work for it. Washington isn't working. I'm not giving any more money to anybody till they go to work. How about that for a thought?
There you go. Then that is an excellent point to end on. Great. David Lawton, I appreciate the time from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I appreciate you coming over here to the Radisson Hotel here in Manchester, New Hampshire. Quick break. Right back with our coverage from the Republican primary here in New Hampshire. Stick around. Right back after this.
Not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around and everybody said this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
That united we bargain, divided we bear.
A bipartisan majority in Washington has been quietly funding a multi-million-dollar educational initiative to lift people up. Great! Except that the initiative is not for hard-hit Americans, but for Afghanistan. Actually, only top Afghan officials can participate and get ready to upchuck. This so-called educational effort is to teach the corrupt leaders of President Hamid Karzai's regime the art of public relations. Specifically, how to hold news conferences. How's that going, you ask? Not well. Though in fairness, let's acknowledge that Karzai's officials have at least begun to hold a few actual press meetings. Previously, Afghan ministries required the media to submit any questions by fax, which was a bit of a runaround since they had no working fax machines. So, this is counted as a giant step forward. Now, though, U.S. instructors have abruptly withdrawn from the PR school. Apparently, they're annoyed that Karzai and his cohorts keep criticizing and frustrating our efforts to help them establish a functioning government. Last year, for example, the Afghan Attorney General expelled American advisors from his office after they kept pushing him to prosecute cases of blatant corruption against his fellow officials. Still, while our advisors, instructors, and mentors have been pulled, our money has not. American financing of the PR school continues. It's all part of our $8 billion tax dollars a month, that Washington keeps airlifting into Afghanistan, while our own people's educational and job training needs are being slashed. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, at least Obama is getting us out of Afghanistan in 2014, right? Well, he says so, but Pentagon warhawks say they want to negotiate with Karzai to keep thousands of American forces there and billions more of our tax dollars beyond Obama's deadline.
If you'd like more of Jim Hightower's real populism, check out the Hightower Lowdown. Jim's monthly newsletter gives you the real lowdown on which corporations, by name, are doing what to the middle class, our environment, and our democracy. Each month, the Hightower Lowdown brings you facts you didn't know, along with actions you can take to fight back. It also comes with a sense of humor. Hightower believes we can fight the gods and still have fun. Plus, get this, it's cheap. Only $15 brings you 12 issues a year. For real populism, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show.
sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Great event here in Manchester. I'm sitting here with Alex Seitz-Walden, Travis Waldron from thinkprogress.org. They're fairly regular guests over at Think Progress. It's great to see you guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You guys have been out on the streets talking to the voters. What sense are you getting from folks? What's the sense you get out of everybody?
Definitely a lot less enthusiasm than 2008 from everyone we're talking to. We were talking to a poll worker earlier, and she was saying that there's nowhere near the turnout. We talked to one guy who was started as a Mitt Romney supporter, then switched over to Santorum. Everyone seems to be sort of blasé, you know, kind of they're going to vote, but they're not too excited about it.
Yeah, they're going to go in and pull the lever. I was downstairs last night as we were cutting out of here, and there was a whole bunch of, you know, people who've come here from out of state saying, yeah, we're bird watching, but there aren't many birds around. And, you know, the celebrities, because that's who they are, aren't coming through. The candidates weren't coming through. There's a sense that people are let down.
Well, there's another thing, too. It seems like there's a lot of political tourists here. It's kind of hard to find voters at different times.
Boy, is that true.
We go out and, you know, it's like, hey, are you a New Hampshire voter? It's like, no, I'm from, you know, Massachusetts, Virginia, somewhere like that. It's, you know, where are all the Granite Staters?
That's exactly what happened. I went to a Huntsman event, and it was mostly media. It was mostly people from other places, a handful of voters. And you know, the one person who brought a baby, I got a picture of Huntsman kissing the baby. Wouldn't answer a question about trade policy, but he'd kiss babies.
Sounds like the correct politician thing to do. You know, he's already getting a good start on that.
So how are you going to see this thing going tonight? I mean, Romney's obviously the guy. From who you're talking to, what kind of thoughts are you getting? Who's going to be number two and down?
I think, I think the race for number two is between Huntsman and Paul. And the real question is, Romney's been slipping a little bit in the polls. How far does he slide? Because the conventional wisdom would be the voters who leave Romney are most likely leaving for Huntsman. So as one drops, the other will rise.
Right.
And that Huntsman needs a strong finish here to keep going. Paul's going to keep going no matter what, and Romney will have to wait for, you know, everyone to tell us whether he won big enough or not big enough.
Well, he'll tell us.
Well, he'll tell us. The, you know,
right.
The New York Times will tell us.
And
somebody
Perry,
will tell us.
And Perry's putting his all his money down on South Carolina.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Buddy Romer beats Rick Perry here, which would be pretty embarrassing for the sitting governor of the second largest state in the country to lose to, you know, kind of a fringe-ish candidate. I like Buddy
Romer. I like
Romer.
Buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. But, you know, hardly compete with Rick Perry's juggernaut.
A guy who hasn't participated in a single debate.
Not one debate. Which I think is a crime. When somebody like Rick Santorum, who polls 1-2%, someone like Michelle Bachmann, who polls 1-2%, why don't you have others like Gary Johnson or Buddy Roman?
Well, it's interesting. Rick Santorum actually wasn't qualified for the Saturday night debate until he finished second in Iowa. Because if you finish in the top four, I think, in Iowa, you're automatically qualified for the debate. But he wasn't polling high enough here to get into the debate. So it's kind of, it's kind of odd to draw the line. Buddy Romer is a two-term former governor of Louisiana. It's not like he's, you know, just some guy who came out of nowhere and decided to run for president.
Yeah, a guy who's working at the McDonald's and, hey, that sounds like a good job. Let's jump into that. So as you're out at these events talking to people, what sense of the issues do you get? Or the sense I got, it seems more, I like this guy because the woman told me Huntsman looks presidential. That's why she's supporting him.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that, and that's why you see at these events, they put a lot of time and effort into the, you know, theatricality of it. They like to have voters standing behind. But the people we talk to, they, you know, they talk about whether they think the guy is too establishment or too, or, you know, anti-establishment, or whether his temperament is good. And, yeah, it sort of seems to be people voting with their gut, not really with their issues. Because on a lot of these issues, you know, they're pretty similar. You sort of have, like, different brands of radical, you know, right-wing extremism, but they're basically all in the same spectrum of things.
But a lot of times, it doesn't make sense. Today we talked to a guy at one of the polls who said, I voted for Newt Gingrich because I think Mitt Romney is a little too establishment. And, you know, here you have a guy who, I don't buy Mitt Romney's line that he is not a career politician, because the only reason he's not is because he's lost.
Right.
But he's only been in office for 4 years. Newt Gingrich was in the House for 30 and was the Speaker of the House. So if you're going away from the establishment but going to Newt Gingrich, doesn't really make sense.
Well, it'd be like someone like me saying, well, I don't like Mitt Romney because he destroyed a bunch of jobs with Bain Capital, sucking all the retirement benefits and all the assets out. I'm voting for Newt Gingrich, even though he was on the board of directors of a company that did the exact same thing.
Right.
So as you're talking to these folks, what's been your favorite moment being here? What sticks out when you go home? You say this moment really encapsulates the whole trip for me. Or have you had that yet?
It's tough to say. I will say though that I think what we were just talking about, the John Huntsman supporters we've talked to have been the most informed and the most. We talked to a couple guys last night outside of John Huntsman's rally in Exeter. And I was really impressed with their knowledge, and they, you know, actually seemed to be voting on what they were. So I have to say that was a little bit, you know, it's easy to get cheeky and to get snarky about this kind of stuff, but that kind of heartened me, you know, about the democratic process and all those kinds of notions that I still like to believe in. You know, to meet a couple of guys, don't disagree with them at all ideologically, but they knew what they were talking about, and they voted for somebody that they really believed in. So maybe a little corny, but that'd be my moment.
Yeah.
I think mine was, it was funny, we were actually at this Mitt Romney event yesterday. And we just drove over there because we heard he was actually going to do a media availability, and we were standing there waiting for him to come back, and it was just kind of like, this is a major, like, presidential campaign. This guy could potentially be the next president, and here I am standing 10 feet from him. You know, it's just the whole spectacle. There's 200 reporters there. The whole spectacle is fun. It's
yeah,
just,
I mean,
it's interesting. It's a show, and it's... Yeah, obviously it's very important, but it's fun to be a part of.
Yeah, absolutely. I got the same sense, you know, back when Obama was running. You know, I got to shake his hands a number of times. And, you know, people find that important. I personally didn't, but, you know, it is what it is. And that's what I like about here in New Hampshire. I'd always thought there was more discussion that went on at these things instead of more of a popularity contest, that you were really there to discuss issues. And that's the one thing I've been disappointed about that I haven't seen.
I will say this, building on his point, though, is I've been pleasantly surprised, and maybe because I grew up in a place where politics just wasn't that important, I've been pleasantly surprised at how seriously the New Hampshire voter takes their responsibility, though. I mean, there are a lot of people that just are showing up to see this, and they know that it's important that they do it, and that's great.
So where do you see this going from here? When we're down to South Carolina, obviously Romney's the guy to beat. Where do you see that going in the days coming forward?
Well, I think kind of ironically, I think Romney might be in for a bit of a surprise tonight. And, you know, everyone's expecting a huge, huge win. I think he's going to win, but it might be less than everyone's expecting. And that could, you know, kind of hurt him. But in a way, it might help him in the long term. If he finishes less than expected and it keeps the other candidates in the race, then that'll split the conservative vote, split the anti-Romney vote. You know, going South Carolina into Florida and Nevada. So that'll help Romney sort of coast along with this, you know, he's never really been able to break above 30%. So if he can keep going on that stream without really breaking through, that might actually help him in the long run.
And on top of that, I think, building on that, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, that Huntsman needs a strong performance or else it's going to be really hard to go on. And I think the other two to watch on that note are Santorum and Gingrich.
Right.
They're running neck and neck in the polls. They're kind of playing for the same general base of anti-Romney voter. If one of them kind of pulls away from the other tonight, it could build the case that the other needs to go.
Yeah, so. I think Santorum does need to go for a whole plethora of other reasons. But in the end of this, the longer this goes, the more obviously it helps Obama. Because they're just, and I love watching it, they're eating each other.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that's the really key thing that happened yesterday, especially after Mitt Romney's firing line, where every candidate piled on him for being, you know, a Wall Streeter, a corporate raider. Now they just completely legitimized every attack that Obama is going to use against Mitt Romney. You know, he can say Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry said it. And so they've basically just handed a huge talking point to Obama and the DNC.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, Newt is like Obama's top surrogate at this point. It's like, you know, Newt Gingrich had his moment at the top of the polls, and now that he's not there anymore, it's like kamikaze mission.
Scorched earth.
To take out Mitt Romney at all costs.
That
and
is,
the Obama people have to just love it.
Oh, they have to. Maybe they're even donating to his campaign.
Keep him alive.
You know, because you got to love that scorched earth mentality. That is the Republican way. Alex, Travis, I appreciate you guys stopping by. I'd love to talk to you more as we continue down this road.
Thanks very much.
It's always great. Both Travis Sites Walden, Travis Waldron. I'll get it right, Alex, from thinkprogress.org. Quick break back after this to wrap things up.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com. And search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We got this question. What makes a rooster decide to crow? The answer from scientists is that it has something to do with an alarm clock.
A rooster crows because he has an internal clock that helps him anticipate sunrise. Like all birds, roosters sing or crow in a daily cycle. Almost all animals have daily cycles of activity, circadian rhythms, that roughly follow the cycle of day and night. Roosters anticipate sunrise to get a head start on their daily hunt for food and defensive territory.
But if one rooster in the neighborhood has an internal clock that's set a little early, he can stimulate other roosters to crow early, too. The rooster's sunrise song is actually a way of establishing his territory. When a rooster crows, he's sending out a signal to other roosters that if they trespass, they're asking for a fight.
A rooster will often crow from a vantage point above his territory, so he can make others more aware of his presence, and so his songs travel farther. Even though roosters are the most famous crooners of the chicken world, hens aren't exactly silent either. When a hen spots a hawk, she'll let out a harsh squawk to send her chicks into hiding. But if she sees a less threatening human, she might just cackle. I'm Deborah Berg.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
They blame with some justification the problems in the financial sector for getting us into this mess. And they're dissatisfied with the policy response here in Washington. And at some level, I can't blame them. Certainly 9% unemployment and very slow growth is not a very good situation.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So it's been interesting watching Romney taking a beating from all of the other candidates for his, all the things he did with Bain Capital. And this is a discussion I think that has to be had, should have been had years ago, especially during the 80s and 90s when people like Romney and his front group were robbing pensions and looting assets for themselves. I mean, this whole idea that he's creating jobs seems kind of nonsensical to me, even when his partner comes out and says, I didn't realize we were creating jobs. I thought we were making money. Thought we were making money. So there you go. Anyway, one of the great things about coming out here to Manchester is that you get to talk to folks who have wandered by. And I've got Mark Provost here. He is with the Occupy the Primary group that's set up across the street from the Radisson here. He's also an economic journalist. He's gotten some play out of the fact that he was one of the folks who was able to question Mitt Romney, and, well, he lost. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Rick.
So tell me, the occupation going across the street, what's the Occupy the Primary?
Yeah, we have the Occupy the New Hampshire Primary, and basically what we did is we set up an event, a four-day event, really, from January 6th through January 10th, and we organized it around two-hour time slots so that Occupy groups throughout the entire Northeast from Maine, Vermont, Worcester, Boston, Albany, Wall Street, New Haven, they all came up and they grabbed a slot to do a teach-in or to do a workshop, to have some direct actions. We have a lot of great, we had a whole lineup, a schedule of events for 4 days straight. And if you don't feel like staying at the park, we're always getting basically intelligence in about where the candidates are so we can go out there and bird dog them, ask them hard questions, mic check them.
And just ask them the questions that need to be asked.
Yeah, basically.
Especially when you're talking about economics and you're talking about healthcare, the things that I think the party loyalists will never ask. You know, most of the folks that I talked to when we went up to one of the events there in Henniker, it was more about personality. I'm going to meet so-and-so, and he looks so presidential. But when you start talking about the issues, there's no depth there.
No, there's really no depth, and at the same time, there's no substantive policy difference between many of the major Republican candidates. They blame President Obama for destroying the economy, and they said it's his regulatory zeal bringing in big business. But and you know, President Obama's administration just needs to get out of the way, and the business recovery will lead on its own. But what we've seen, invisible hand, right? But in the last couple of years, corporate profits have reached record highs, and that's coincident with the highest unemployment in 70 years and attendant wage stagnation. So clearly, business has had sway in this country, not just in the last 2 years, but the last 30. And it seems that no party or serious candidate really wants to reverse those trickle-down economic policies.
Yeah, as an economic journalist, the messaging that you're seeing and hearing, is it any different than the last 30 years of Reaganomics, where we've basically gone down this path of we need to deregulate and we need to hand everything to the folks at the top because evidently they know better than we know how to create an economy?
Right. I mean, they call the private sector the job creators, but there's a statistic that some people aren't familiar with, really, and that's the United States private sector hasn't created one net new job in 10 years. Right. So, but you hear the de facto position of the leading candidates, and not just the leading candidates, but I'd say the party heads, both at the DNC and the RNC, they both talk. Harry Reid was saying the same thing about how the private sector. Austin Goolsbee was saying the same thing. Obama's chief economic advisor for a while, and the Republicans all have that line that the private sector is the only one that can create jobs, and the key to creating more jobs is to lavish huge rewards and quote-unquote incentives on these job creators, which are of course corporations. But like I said, in the last 10 years, the private sector hasn't created one net new job. So if we were to draw an analogy, all right, between the U.S. government and the private sector and how they that line, if you want to find an analogy, it'd be like the prospective employer is looking for who to hire. He's got a whole bunch of different options for who to hire, but he's only going to hire the person with a 10-year job gap in their history. They're only going to hire that person. They've got a whole stack of ways to fix this economic crisis, but they're only going to focus on the one that's failed for 10 years.
Right. Well, I mean, that is their ideology, and it's, what I love is how they've laid all of this at the feet of Obama, saying this is all his fault, seeming to forget about September of 2008. When the economy began its free fall.
Or September 2006 or September 2000.
But that moment, September of 2008, people saw. They didn't really see it in 2006. They didn't see it in 2007. In 2008, when they were saying the country is coming to a collapse,
mm-hmm.
We need this TARP money or it's the end of the United States. The banking system is going to collapse. It's that moment when people woke up and said, well, for a second anyway, maybe we got some real problems. And I agree with you. I mean, for the last 30 years, we've been pursuing this. If we hand everything off to the top, it will rain down on us like golden honey, and it just hasn't happened.
Yeah, I mean, why I said September 2006 is because I would say that September 2006 is within months of the peak of the Bush recovery. But at that time, the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, they do regular semi-annual polling, and Americans in at the peak of the Bush recovery were more pessimistic about the U.S. economy going forward than they were since the middle of the 1980-81 Reagan recession. So at the very peak, actually, if you just cared about what Americans said for an opinion, their opinion was the economy was in absolute tatters, and at the peak of an economic growth phase, Americans were about as pessimistic as they were since the worst recession in post-war history up until this one. So all you have to do is really look at the American people, take it halfway seriously, and you can see that actually for most Americans, they were at least 2 years ahead of most major economists and most politicians in sensing that there was something wrong with the economy. Interestingly enough, the policy approaches in both the magnitude and scale were diametrically opposed. Like you said, Americans have been falling behind for 30 years, but no American families or working people have been falling behind for more than 30 years. And at no point did politicians say, this is the end of the world. This is all going to collapse. We need to help these people. We need $5 trillion for American families, right?
That's the point.
That didn't happen.
Nope.
They never turned around. But the banks, the second they got into trouble, like you said, in 2008, we said, now it's the end of the world. The rich people are going to lose their money. It's the end of the world. And within 4 months, these banks were back to record profits. So my whole point is it seems that socialism works in this country, at least for some, right?
Yep.
They were doing well for 30 years. They said, oh, Wall Street's going to collapse, and if Wall Street collapses, Main Street collapses. Within 4 months, they're back to record profits, and most of it was because of federal government intervention. So, I mean, for those people that say socialism doesn't work, it does work for some.
Well, those at the top. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're at Mark Provost. He's an economic journalist and one of the folks who out bird-dogging the candidates. Big news, you were the one who asked a question of Mitt Romney. How'd that go? I guess he snubbed you, if I'm not mistaken.
No. I think he attempted to trip me up. The story basically is the night before Romney, we've had a list, New Hampshire Citizens Alliance. They've done great work. And Olivia Zink, she's the one who trained me in bird dogging. I didn't take too many bird dogging classes with her, and I haven't done this too often, but I did remember the cardinal rule, which is ask the first question. So she called me and said, I think you should show up to the event tomorrow. And she wasn't even there, but I was joined by another occupier, and just two of us. And we got into the event. I put a Romney bumper sticker on my sweater. I sat in the front row. Halfway through, he said something about the Keystone XL pipeline to no applause. So I gave him a rousing boo, and he still called on me first. And I asked him, I said, I didn't want a mic check, and we only had two people. And the night before, Mitt Romney was mic checked by Occupy Iowa Caucus, and he kind of brushed it off. And it even galvanized his supporters because they started chanting, and it kind of electrified an otherwise, you know, dismal Romney affair. So I said, I'm going to change tactics a little, pivot. So I said, I introduced myself as a person, Mark, from Occupy Movement. I said, I'm from Occupy Boston. I'm from Occupy New Hampshire. And I said, congratulations on your victory, Mr. Romney in Iowa. I said, Mr. Romney, you have said that corporations are people. In the last 2 years, corporate profits have reached record highs directly at the expense of workers' wages. And I cited a J.P. Morgan report. I said, in light of these facts, will you refine your earlier statement from corporations are people to corporations are abusive people? And I followed that by asking if he was willing to reverse the corporate-centric economic policies of both President Obama and all his predecessors going back 30 years, which sees the wealth and income spiral to the top and the working and middle classes seemingly stuck in a permanent economic stagnation. I also noted the dichotomy that the United States is a great place to be a corporation, but increasingly it's a desperate place to live and work.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right on that. And the answer he gave you was kind of was his stump answer. I mean, corporations are people, and the money flows to them. Well, people can.
Yeah, I think there was two parts of it. First, the microphone went away from me, and then he asked me where profits went to. So he made the mistake of getting the microphone back into my hands. And That was definitely a big mistake because he said, well, where do profits go? I said, well, they went to profits. So I put the ball in the dirt, right? But so then he tried to dig in thinking I was just some ignorant person. He says, no, well, where do they go? Well, I said, well, profits go. If you don't distribute them to the dividends and you don't pay for a capital expenditure, then they're called retained earnings, and that means they're being hoarded. But in any case, even if they're not hoarded, profits benefit shareholders, of which the 1% owns 90% of the stock, which is not true. They only own 60%. But in any case, the top 1% own more financial wealth than the bottom 99% combined. So it's not that inaccurate. And anyway, I annihilated Mr. Romney. He had nothing to say other than he made two statements of fact in his response. One was that buildings don't pay taxes, which I think everyone's already aware of. And two is corporations don't pay taxes. On that, they're supposed to pay taxes, but corporate taxes as a percentage of GDP and as a percentage of federal revenue are both at 50-year lows. So, you know, when you hear the story of budget cuts and austerity, you have to remember the wealthiest corporations in the country are, you know, they've been great work by Bloomberg and by Businessweek on the fact that corporate profits have rebounded so strongly in the last 2 years, but yet corporate taxes are nowhere near where they were 2 years ago. So they're making more money than ever, but they're not contributing to the federal revenue.
They're pocketing more of it and sitting in there. And you go back to the 50s, you know, the golden era where they keep talking about how wonderful things were. Corporations were paying around 30% of the total tax
revenue.
Receipts coming in.
Yep.
Now it's under 7%. So you're talking about a massive redistribution of wealth from corporations, from people to the corporation.
Sure, and what's even more troubling about that, if you think about it, is that corporations are actually benefiting more than they did 30 years ago. So it's the government that they denigrate constantly has benefited them, whether it's through trade policy, labor policy, corporate governance policy, whether it's the lack of doing nothing about the unemployment crisis. The whole range of policies that funnel income and wealth to the top benefit them so well, but yet, like an abusive person, they can only denigrate the government that helps them, and they can only denigrate the workers that contribute to their earnings.
Corporations as wife beaters. Interesting. I think I like that.
It's definitely accurate. It's definitely accurate.
Last question I've got for you is: you're looking at all of these candidates. You know, are there any of them that you see viable? Anybody, anyone, any better than the other, or are they all the same? In an economic job sense, in a, how we're going to get out of this crisis?
I think to a large extent, I think they all kind of embrace the logic of austerity and deregulation. And to the extent that they embrace that agenda, I think that they are calling for more of the same and a continuation of the status quo. I don't see how people say we're going to unlock jobs in this country by doing the same exact thing we've always done. Right. We're just going to lavish tax breaks on people and, you know,
if we fill their pockets enough, something has to fall out. And then when it falls out, we can fight over the crumbs.
Right, yeah, that's the whole supply-side philosophy that goes back 30 years. You know, there's not enough cash in investors' hands so that they can invest. But, you know, we've seen 30 years of wealth accumulating at the top. And the fact is it's a blockage to the circulatory system of capital. All the money is going to the top, but the propensity to spend that money is lower just by definition among higher income earners.
Yep.
So that the people who actually spend the majority of their money, sometimes they spend more than they make, their earnings right now are at the lowest share in U.S. history. Workers right now are having the lowest share of the economic pie in the United States. So when you have all these politicians addressing the economic concerns, that seems to be the economic concern through polls and just through basic common sense. If the workers in this country are receiving the smallest share in history, isn't that a cause for concern?
No, that's the reason why we need no unions. That's
yeah.
the reason we need to destroy the unions.
Right,
of course.
Right, right. I mean, you know, the United States has the fourth lowest union membership in the OECD countries, and the decline in unions and the increase in inequality are almost perfectly correlated. And the countries that did not witness a dramatic decline in union membership have not witnessed a severe increase in inequality.
Right. Mark Provost, I appreciate the time, economic journalist. Where can we find some of your work?
You can find it at Truthout, Counterpunch, the Institute for Policy Studies, Too Much Online, and inequality.org. I'm also a contributing blogger at The Real News, Naked Capitalism, Economic Populist, and several others.
So you're basically everywhere. Mark, I appreciate the
Thank
time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Great
Thank you,
work.
Rick.
I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Oh, 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of
90% of the people own 90% of the world.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws and limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Look at what's going on here today, and I sure hope so. I sure hope that's the case. Early thoughts coming in. There's some predictions. Ron Paul going to win it. And I think back to the other day at the hotel with the Paulians. I'm sure hoping that's the world we don't live in. Trash the hotel. Jeez, oh, man. But I think, as Pelosi said, I think this president, he's going to have to run against this Congress. He's going to have to run up against the fact that nothing's gotten done. And why is that? Well, obstruction, delay, gridlock. That's the problem. Got an email during the break. Bill says that the right to work guy needs an enema. So there you go. Also, Chad sent me an email questioning my take on what I guess the Belisario is his name. Al Belisario. He's the state rep here. We were talking about China. We're talking about right to work. And what Chad writes is the veteran said companies that are affected by incoming unions are forced to stay in business by moving overseas to China. He did not say companies want to compete with China. And, you know, again, you know, they're in a position where you're right. They have to compete. They don't want to compete with anybody. They want monopoly. But they're being forced because of our trade policies and what we've set up to force to compete with the Chinese. And I didn't twist his words at all. He said that they're going to China. Now, whose fault is that? Well, again, I say it's our trade policies. It's the way we interact. The fact that we have no tariffs. The fact that we've followed this free trade model where we're going to open up our doors to whoever wants to dump their stuff in here. It seems like bad policy to me. Anyway, as he was, what I loved about his argument, because he was pushing that right to work argument, which is we should be able to go get jobs from other states, and there are jobs who are going to right to work states, so New Hampshire should turn into a right to work state so that we could steal jobs from Massachusetts. That was basically his argument, so that we could steal jobs from, you know, New York or Connecticut or Pennsylvania. Because, oh, we're the right-to-work haven. But understand, if we do what Romney wants to do, which is to make this a right-to-work nation, that beggar thy neighbor economic development is not going to work. But they don't want to talk about that. And for me, it comes down to some pretty simple stuff. Are we creating jobs for the benefit of we as a country or for individuals, for individual states? And you know, I love that one nation under God thing, because I believe that one nation, country first. The Paulbots would tell you that, well, individual first. My liberty, my freedom, me. Which, you know, they displayed quite well. Hotel is they basically trashed the place. So is it possible for the GOME? Is country first possible? I mean, you look at the agenda that they have, and we've talked about it for the last 2 days. We have seen what they've had to say, and they've been honest. And that's the thing I guess I can give the Republicans credit for. They feel emboldened right now. They feel that they have all of the stars have aligned, that all of the things that they've been talking about in their little think tanks and all of their backroom little secret clubs and whispering to each other like giddy little schoolgirls, now they feel emboldened that they have control, that they can now say what they really mean, which is we want a race-to-the-bottom economy. We want workers working for pennies on the dollar. You know, they talk about we want to create jobs. Well, what kind of jobs? Do we want Rick Perry-type jobs, minimum wage? Do we want Michelle Bachmann-type jobs? Do away with the minimum wage? Is that the direction as a nation we need to go? And I say no. Why do we want someone between workers and their employers? The party of small government, I just don't get it. And what I'm hoping is that some of the people we talked to over the past 2 days have, maybe this is going to be that moment where workers say, you know what, that party's too extreme for me. Workers may eventually get the fact, and I've talked to numerous union members who have been rock rib Republicans, who have said, I just cannot support a party that won't support me. And look, I'm as fiscally conservative as anybody. I believe in paying your bills. You know, in my own life, I do the same thing. My mortgage is paid for. My credit cards are paid for every month. My bills are paid every month. And I think as a nation, we should be doing the same thing. The question is, how do we do that? We've agreed. That's the destination. The destination is we need to pay our bills. How do we do it? Do we do it by taking food out of the mouths of children? Do we do it by taking health care away from people? Do we do it by harming the least among us? Or do we turn around and say, you know what, we need to raise some revenue. And, hey, you know, top 1%, Romneyites, you've done really well. When times were great, you did really well. You lined your pockets. We now need you to pitch in. We now need you to say, you know what, it's an American thing to do. You know, make it patriotic if you have to. Maybe that's something that they will, no, trust me, the investor class of this country, they don't care about patriotism. They care about dollars. They care about lining their pockets. They care about putting money in their pocket. You know, when Romney was at the height of Bain Capital, if you'd have thrown a flag in his face, if it was green, it was the only way he was going to march to it. And I think his one partner was at least honest. And he said, look, I didn't know we were in the business of creating jobs. I thought we were in the business of making money. And that's being honest. So I look at this, and I'm looking forward to South Carolina. The results I'm hoping we'll see soon. As I said, early numbers say, early thoughts are Paul Romney, Gingrich. Man, if Ron Paul won, would that not throw a wrench into the whole plan? No, I mean, probably not. But the psychic monkey, the psychic spider monkey, has picked Newt Gingrich. Ate his banana first, Santorum's banana second. Probably not the right thing to say, Santorum banana, probably. Sorry, that was a reference. Now, I'm going to use that. He absolutely avoided us when he came into the room. All of his surrogates avoided us. In fact, the people who were running this event, I said, what is it about Santorum's people that they don't want to come near you? I'm going, because we're probably doesn't want to face up to the fact that we know what he's done in Pennsylvania. and we don't want him to do it to the nation. But anyway, the spider monkey, Grandpa, the spider monkey, has predicted Huntsman third, Perry fourth, Romney last. I think the spider monkey is, I think the psychic spider monkey is wrong. I don't see Romney finishing last. But there you go. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, best place to go to get it. If you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. On the podcast, I think we're gonna add a couple of the segments that we didn't play that we recorded earlier for some bonus coverage so that you'll be able to take that with you as we go. I've had a magnificent time here in Manchester. I hope you enjoyed our coverage. We look forward to being back in the studio on Thursday. Tomorrow, our good friend attorney Erwin Aronson and Dr. Stephen Herzenberg. Have a great night. We'll see you Thursday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. The monster is coming.